Welcome to the March 1, 2021 meeting of the Cheyenne Public Utility District Board of Commissioners. This morning, we're meeting in a study session and this afternoon in a business session. And I need to share with my fellow commissioners before we go any further that at 11 o'clock, I will be handing off the conduct of the meeting to Commissioner McKenna. I have a national meeting to run with policymakers for public power shortly after that. And so I need to take that that role, and Commissioner McKenna has agreed to take the role of running this meeting. All commissioners are present. It appears to me that the staff in the boardroom, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, are General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfine. Due to COVID, we are meeting remotely, and while normally I would remind everyone to silence their cell phones, today I just ask you to try to remember to remain on mute during the meeting unless you're speaking on a subject matter. Since we do value public input at our meetings, we will be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of the morning session and at the end of our afternoon session. And if you wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded. We wish to have an accurate record of that meeting. Additionally, if there's any item on the agenda that you, any visitor would like to provide input or talk about at that appropriate moment on the agenda, I would ask that you share that with us at this time, and we can get you recognized at the appropriate moment. Hearing nobody, I'd like to move on to our first item on our agenda, and that's the Pledge of Allegiance and the Safety Minute brought to us today by Patty Wachtel. And my understanding is Patty couldn't get on visually, but she is on. I do know that we've had that conversation. And so if we could all join in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all. Good morning to all of you in person and online. I apologize that Microsoft Teams did not cooperate with my mic or speakers. So today, our focus as our HPI moment is the COVID pandemic and the district's approach to keeping our employees and customers safe. In our HPI principles, our focus is always on continual learning and constantly improving. With the continuous and rapidly changing requirements and mandates regarding COVID, we have more than ever followed this HPI philosophy. As you know, all the principles can be applied in everything that we do, but the ones most relevant I would like to highlight about the district's COVID pandemic response are that curiosity drives to examine our practices and learn from our errors. And as employees, we are the solution, not the problem. And excellence is not the absence of failure, but the presence of process and defenses. Cheyenne County PUD is committed to providing a safe and healthy workplace for all our employees and customers. And we must always continue to provide essential services while at the same time protecting our employees and the public. Part of our defenses to support our employees have been to allow them to work remotely where possible, develop partnerships with our medical facilities on COVID process and response, have readily available services for testing our employees as needed when situations warranted under certain scenarios, ensure that any interactions with the public and or contractors and district employees are always conducted in a safe and social distancing manner while still providing service or accomplishing the work. We provide personal protective equipment and readily available cleansing protocols to all our employees in their work areas. A pandemic recovery team was established and continuously monitors data changes in federal, state, and local guidelines so that we can readily modify district-wide and specific business unit measures and actions accordingly. Be an active community partner in supporting testing and or vaccine efforts as we continue shoring up our defenses to combat this pandemic, as you may have heard some of our partnerships in the Toyota Center. And district employees have also shown significant community support and appreciation to our health services community as they continue to take care of our employees and the community. As we know through HPI, we can all make mistakes, cannot claim that the district has perfectly always executed responses to this pandemic. But our questioning attitude on our approaches have allowed us to refine our processes and improve our internal contact tracing. I believe the district can be proud on how employees have responded and continue to do so in their efforts to combat this COVID pandemic by keeping everyone as safe as possible. In a workforce such as ours, where critical work is performed daily and on many occasions requires our employees to work in close quarters, I am amazed that overall, our count in a year of dealing with the coronavirus, our positive cases remain relatively low, and the overwhelming majority have not been as a result of our existing work environments that we strive to keep as safe as possible for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Patty. Commissioners, any questions or comments for Patty? I guess I'd like to say thank you so much, Patty. I know that this has been a long year in the virtual setting, and for those of us that have recently been able to get our vaccines, I know there's a great sense of personal relief having achieved that. And at the same time, I think there's probably a heightened sense of personal responsibility that we now have, recognizing that this still isn't over and we still have a responsibility not only to ourselves but to everybody at the utility to help maintain our vigilance. And what we've been doing at the utility, I think, is something we can be very proud of. And so thank you for that really good safety moment.
Thank you very much.
All right, commissioners, item two on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. Staff has made a recommendation that we move resolutions 11 and 12 to the consent agenda. And as normal, any item that is on the consent agenda can also be moved from the consent agenda. But at this moment in time, I would entertain any changes other than what staff has recommended to the agenda. And if there's no objection, I would ask, you know, that we approve the agenda with the two movements to the consent agenda. Does that meet with the approval of the commission? We don't need a motion, but if there's no objection, we can consider the consent or the agenda altered as recommended. Does that work?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Great. At this time, I'll turn it over to Steve Wright.
Okay. We want to begin today with a quarterly fish and wildlife update. Lean Underwood, Ian Adams, and Catherine Willard will be presenting. Turn it over to them.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, commissioners. This is Lean Underwood. I'm the Fish and Wildlife Manager for the PUD. So we've got two great examples of our environmental stewardship stories to share with you today. First, Ian Adams is going to discuss meeting our permit requirements for the total daily maximum load of phosphorus in the Wenatchee River at our Dryden Acclimation Facility. And then Catherine is going to reinvigorate our discussion of hatchery versus wildfish and discuss further hatchery fitness that we deal with on an everyday basis while implementing our hatchery programs under our HCP. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ian. Ian, I think you're still on mute. Okay, Rebecca, what's the protocol here?
I can move forward to Catherine's portion if you like, and maybe we can come back to Ian. Or
sure.
Do you want to cover this information?
No, let's go ahead and move to Catherine. Catherine, if you're on, and then I will contact Ian.
That sounds good. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Right there, Rebecca. That's perfect. Good morning. Commissioner Congdon and I had a conversation about the differences between hatchery and wildfish this past summer, and she requested that I provide a brief overview to the board on why there are differences between hatchery fish compared to wildfish. Next slide, please. Fitness between hatchery and wildfish can be different. Wildfish are often more fit than hatchery fish. The cause of this difference in fitness essentially comes down to multiple differences in their rearing environments. For hatchery programs, adult fish are trapped in the tributaries, brought to the hatchery where they are spawned. Their fertilized eggs are incubated in trays, and they spend the next year and a half in a raceway, like the one in the picture on the left here at East Bank Hatchery. While at the hatchery, the fish are fed, and for the most part, they are protected from predators, and they are fed multiple times throughout the day. A pretty easy life, really. This is compared to wild fish. They return to the tributaries to spawn. Their fertilized eggs incubate in gravel in a stream bed, and they spend the next year and a half in a river using energy to find optimal habitats while they're competing for food and avoiding predators. It literally is survival of the fittest. The reduced fitness of hatchery fish is caused by being reared in a controlled hatchery environment versus a wild environment. Next slide. In an attempt to address reduced fitness of hatchery fish, the district has implemented various tools to minimize the potential negative effects the hatchery rearing environment can cause. One of these tools is rearing fish in circular vessels. I'll describe to you how rearing fish in circular vessels compared to traditional raceways can improve the fitness of hatchery fish. The district began piloting a circular partial water reuse vessel in 2009 at our East Bank Hatchery, and that's what this picture is here on the left. The partial water reuse system had known operational benefits in that they use less water and discharge cleaner water as effluent. The system has a higher water velocity or stronger water current than traditional flow through raceways. This higher water velocity contributes to removing fish waste from the water, allowing the water to be reused. We found that fish reared in the circular vessels had improved fitness because they were swimming in a water current, similar to what they would experience in a stream. Essentially, the fish were being enrolled in an exercise program. We are able to infer an increase in fitness by looking at outmigration survival for Wenatchee River steelhead smolts overwinter acclimated in circular vessels compared to a raceway at our district's Chihuahua acclimation facility. We measure survival from the point of release into the Wenatchee River downstream to McNary Dam using pit tags. The figure on the right shows outmigration survival was higher 3 out of 3 years for steelhead reared in circular vessels compared to fish reared in a raceway. We're essentially producing fitter fish by enrolling them in this exercise program. Next slide, please. Another potential issue with hatchery fish is a higher rate of strain compared to wild fish. Salmon and steelhead return to the stream that they were born. This is called homing. They know where to return to by using smell. Every water source has its own smell. For example, Nason Creek smells different than the Chihuahua River to salmon and steelhead. If fish do not home to where they were born and return to a different stream, this is called strain. Strain of hatchery fish can have negative genetic, ecological, and fitness effects on wild populations. That is why it's important to minimize it. Another difference in rearing environments between hatchery fish and wild fish can be natal water source. For example, we rear Wenatchee steelhead on well water at East Bank Hatchery. To get fish to home to the Wenatchee River, we then transfer fish to the Chihuahua acclimation facility to overwinter and acclimate on Wenatchee River water. We do this to increase homing to the Wenatchee River when the steelhead return as adults. Conversely, this reduces strain. Before the district constructed the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility, we overwinter acclimated our steelhead program at Turtle Rock Island on Columbia River water. The figure on the right shows stray rates for Wenatchee steelhead that were overwinter acclimated at Turtle Rock compared to fish overwinter acclimated at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility. Stray rates for steelhead overwinter acclimated at Turtle Rock Island averaged 25%, which is way too high. This is compared to average stray rates of 4% for steelhead overwinter acclimated at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility. This low stray rate meets our hatchery permit requirements of 5% or less. Next slide, please. We have, however, found that there can be trade-offs associated with overwinter acclimating Wenatchee steelhead at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility. Overwinter acclimation did reduce stray rates, as I just said. However, smolt out-migration survival from release to McNary Dam has decreased compared to when the steelhead program was acclimated at Turtle Rock Island, as demonstrated in this figure here. Mean out-migration survival for fish overwinter acclimated at Turtle Rock Island averaged 54%, compared to an average of 29% out-migration survival for fish overwinter acclimated at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility. Next slide, please.
Catherine, this is Ann.
Yeah.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
So why is that?
Oh, I'm going to tell you. I will tell you here in a second. Yep.
Yeah, okay,
stay
great.
Tuned. So this decline, here you go, in out-migration survival is likely due to smaller fish size that is realized when fish are reared at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility compared to Turtle Rock Island. Larger smolts survive better, as demonstrated in this figure on the left. The more fish in a pound here on the x-axis, the smaller the fish are. So 12 fish in a pound is smaller than 6 fish in a pound. And you can see that survival decreases as the fish are smaller. The smaller steelhead size is caused by water temperature, as seen in the figure on the right. Wenatchee River water winter water temperatures are colder at the Chihuahua Acclimation Facility compared to Columbia River winter water temps that we saw at Turtle Rock Island. When the water temperature is warmer, fish eat more and they grow bigger. So we're currently evaluating our hatchery rearing practices to see how we can make changes to produce larger steelhead that are overwinter acclimated at Chihuahua Acclimation Facility. Next slide, please. In conclusion, the district's hatchery programs have always strived to minimize the potential negative effects of the hatchery rearing environment. Hatchery environments offer a protected environment that can increase survival of fish from the adult broodstock stage to the time of release as smolts, as demonstrated in this graph. This graph includes the adult-to-adult return rates for hatchery fish and wildfish for 4 different PUD hatchery programs. Using the Wenatchee Spring Chinook population as an example, for every 1 adult that is spawned in the hatchery, 8 adults return that are from that 1 hatchery adult offspring. This is compared to an adult-to-adult return rate of 0.6 adult, half a fish, for wildfish. This essentially means that it would take almost 16 wildfish to produce 8 adults versus the 1 hatchery fish to produce 8 adults. As you can see, the return rates for hatchery fish are higher than the return rates for wildfish. And then again, this is due to the protected hatchery rearing environment that offers a survival advantage. The district is continually evaluating ways to minimize the potential negative effects of the hatchery rearing environment, while at the same time optimizing the survival advantage that hatcheries offer. When hatchery programs are operated like the district's hatchery programs are, they can offer a boost to survival and ultimately contribute to rebuilding declining populations and providing harvests for anglers. Next slide. Are there any more questions or comments?
Go ahead, Ann. Well, I was just going to say, you know, I went through this presentation and then hearing your additional comments to it, you know, I really appreciate it. And I guess what I appreciate most is that we often hear on media sources very simplistic responses to, you know, fish runs. And what I appreciate most is the depth of our staff understanding and working with the complexities of this whole issue. And so my compliments to you and the people you work with and Eileen and your department for doing, I think, a really incredible job. And I just wish the public had the same level of understanding and education that we get as commissioners. But thank you for a job well done. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you.
Ann.
Yeah, so Catherine, thanks for bringing this to all of us. So I'm just trying to think this through. So I know we need to get our numbers up. That's part of our no net impact of the dams, you know. So I know the numbers have to increase, but at the same time, as you showed here, there are trade-offs. And I guess I don't know how, just give me your sense of this, if you would, Catherine. Over time, over much time, we all know how natural selection works. And I just fear that over time, we are going to breed out all the wild characteristics that are so critical to fish survival, because we're mandated to meet the numbers, so we have to raise a certain number in the hatchery. So I know you guys have given this a ton of thought and a lot more than I have, so help me with that.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, so as far as your comment about reducing the gene pool, I guess, of wild fish. So we do manage it's a genetic term. So we manage the hatchery genetics. It's called PNI, proportion and natural influence. And so we have requirements that we have to limit the number of hatchery fish that compete or spawn against the wild fish when they spawn in the wild. And so we do that to minimize the hatchery effects on the wild fish. And so in years when we do have large returns, we don't let all the hatchery fish return and spawn with the wild fish, because that would indeed dilute their gene pool. But we haven't really had that issue in a while, because the fish populations the returns have been pretty low. So we haven't had to manage as much of the hatchery fish as we have in the past. And then the other thing we do is we try to have our program size be appropriate, so it doesn't overwhelm the number of natural origin fish or wild fish in the environment as well. So yeah, we do all that, and we do for NNI, the hatchery programs, to meet our NNI requirement for hatchery programs, we fund and provide capacity to rear the hatchery programs, but we're not, I guess, penalized if we don't get a certain number of fish back. But the goal is to rebuild the population.
Okay. That's great. So that index number, PNI, what was that number again that measures the wild characteristics genetically?
It's the number of, it's called PNI, proportion of natural influence. And so it's the proportion of hatchery fish that we will allow to be in a population of wild fish. And so the ideal number is 67% of the fish population should be wild fish compared to hatchery fish. And that will help minimize those hatchery effects. And so we have permit requirements to meet this PNI level. And it was determined by, we get our hatchery permit from NOAA Fisheries, and a lot of really smart geneticists came up with this value, and of course it's a target. And so that's the number that we strive for to minimize negative hatchery effects on the wild populations.
Oh my gosh, that makes me feel so much better. So you have that, you have to meet, and then we don't have to have a hard and fast, we have to contribute to the hatchery program, contribute dollars, but we don't have to have a hard and fast number we have to meet of hatchery fish.
Well,
so
we do.
Therefore, you can balance.
Yeah, so we do have a number that we need to produce of hatchery smolt. But as far as those fish returning as adults, we are not held accountable to that number. But, of course, we strive to have the best returns we can, because the goal is to contribute to harvest, rebuild these populations.
Great. Thank you so much. This is fascinating to me. And people ask me this question, and I really did not have an adequate answer. There are a couple of biologists around and different people that asked the question. So that was a great presentation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Catherine, any other questions for Catherine? Gary.
I have one. Catherine, is there a report that breaks down the major predators or the obstacles that are preventing wild fish from returning back from the ocean to our location? Things like sea lions might be responsible for 2%, and other obstacles might be responsible for that, as well as ocean fisheries.
Yeah.
Is there such a report?
I would have to look. I know there's several different reports that have what sea lion predation is, what ocean conditions are, and the effect on that, and harvest. And so I don't think they're necessarily all in one report, but I could definitely find those individual reports. But you're totally right. There's a combination of factors that affect adult returns, and it's all the way from predators, sea lions, avian predators. Ocean conditions probably have the biggest effect on fish populations. And then habitat, when fish return to spawn, finding the optimal habitat, and also rearing. And so that's why there's several entities in the valley that are working on fish habitat improvement projects through the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board. And our tributary committee contributes funds to these habitat improvement projects.
Any other questions for Catherine? Yeah. So ultimately what you're saying, yeah. Catherine, is, Dennis, go ahead.
Yeah, I have probably a non-related fish question. And since we have Steve Wright and Eileen and you here, and it kind of falls into either it's a figment of my imagination, it's something memory has distorted, or I actually do have the right number in my brain. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. But at a presentation several years ago with about 30 engineers from China, the meeting that we held out at Rocky Reach, a comment was made, if my memory is correct, that utilizing fish hatcheries, fish ladders, for whatever reason, fish are reluctant to scale more than 150-foot elevation gain. That's my memory. Now, where that came from, I'm not entirely sure. And I'm not sure it's accurate. So I guess what I'm asking is that, Steve, do we have your permission to kind of maybe run that statistic down and validate that or not? Because our dams are less than 150 feet, and our fish ladders, you know, work pretty efficiently. But if I remember right in the conversation, they were saying to these Japanese engineers and biologists, that because the dams are higher on in China, it's going to be difficult to get fish to utilize the ladders because they would exceed 150 feet. So again, this could be complete fantasy, or it could be accurate, but it's been too long, and I'd like to have that validated if I could, please.
I'm hoping that Aline wants to step up here.
I do not know that fact off the top of my head, has been a lot of look along dams, other dams at the Columbia, where they've looked at things like that. So I think in pretty, you know, with relative ease, we could figure out if we can find the answer to that question for you and report back.
Okay, and again, don't spend an inordinate amount of time on it just to satisfy my curiosity. But it's just, again, been in the news a lot with Seattle Light and the dams on the Skagit, and what if they just build fish ladders? And those dams are 300 and some feet to 500 and some feet high. And I'm thinking, well, if 150 foot is a barrier, it's not going to be a simple solution. But anyway, just some thoughts, some curiosity.
Great. We'll report back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for Catherine? I'm pretty sure that there's another part of this presentation to go, but I have to make just a couple of comments. That was a marvelous presentation. Spoken in layperson's terms, which I really appreciate. I've never thought about a fish exercise program before. I just want you to know that, but it makes a lot of sense. The other is my mind wandered a little bit to thinking, ultimately, what, you know, with salmon, you've got the four H's, and we're actually trying to make one of those H's disappear to the fish, and that's called hydro, and that's what you're doing, and I understand that and appreciate the work that you go through every day dealing with. We've got our 50-year HCP, and we appreciate what you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve?
Okay, I think we're going to check and see if we can pick up Ian here. So to go back to the first part of this presentation, Ian, are you able to join us?
Steve, can you hear me now?
Ah, there you go. Yes, we can hear you good.
All right. Sorry about that technical difficulty there this morning, but I was able to call back in. I am the Hatchery Maintenance Operations Coordinator for the district, and as you'll see, Rebecca is pulling up a slideshow for us here. All right. Back in 2012, the Department of Ecology issued an addendum to their original TMDL that we were missed in, and this addendum included a discharge allocation of phosphorus for our Dryden acclimation facility. And what I want to draw your attention to here is a couple of columns, the far left column, which is Dryden flow and CFS, and the middle column there that is the total allowable phosphorus concentration in milligrams per liter. And you'll note there's also a little bubble there in the lower left that says the solution to pollution is not always dilution. And in this case, that's absolutely accurate. As you'll notice, if you work from the bottom on that left column up, as flows increase from 1 CFS all the way up to 33 CFS, that total allowable phosphorus concentration is not linear. In fact, the more we flow, the less phosphorus we're allowed to actually discharge. And because milligrams per liter and micrograms per liter are not real common units, the conversion from that 0.0092 milligrams per liter works out in something more tangible to 0.00005 0184 milligrams per teaspoon. So everybody's aware of what a teaspoon looks like. That's not a lot of phosphorus that we're allowed to discharge. Next slide, please. So after we received our allocation in 2012, we began intensely monitoring our water quality in the Dryden pond. And we've got our water quality for the last 9 years broken out into three categories here. You'll notice across the top of this slide, we have broadcast feeding, pre-recalc, we have broadcast feeding post-recalc, and then we have hand feeding. So those first 2 years on the far left under pre-recalc were when we were first aware of our allocation, and we were rearing nearly a million summer snook in the Dryden acclimation facility. So between 2012 and 2013, we went through our recalc, and our mitigation numbers dropped substantially, and we actually dropped down to about 500,000, nearly half of the fish. 60, that made pretty substantial difference in the amount of phosphorus. So there's a couple of really important lines here. About a third of the way up this graph, there is a horizontal dashed, gray dashed line that runs all the way across the dash, or all the way across the x-axis of this figure. And what that represents is our discharge allocation of phosphorus based on our flows that we were controlling in the Dryden pond. So now you can see that dashed line, and up until 2015, we were oftentimes far exceeding our allocation. While we were intensely monitoring our water quality, we were also working with the Department of Ecology, because there was some ambiguity in this addendum that we were trying to figure out how we were going to adhere to. And some of the ambiguity had to do with whether or not we were going to have to include the background phosphorus data, meaning the phosphorus content in the water that is coming into our pond, whether or not we were going to have to include that in our allocation. At first, it looked like we were going to, but after some additional conversations, some site visits, and due diligence, we were able to have the background phosphorus removed from our allocation, so long as we reported both the background and our discharge allocations so that we could provide ecology with a net difference. So between 2015 and 2016, the last vertical line right in the middle of the graph, what we did was we requested our hatchery operators to change their feeding habits. We noticed in the prior years that feed was just being broadcast through a feeder that is drug around behind a pickup, much like a little fertilizer feeder you might walk around in your yard, just a bucket that sprays feed. We went to hand feeding, and we asked our operators to be very diligent and conscientious about how much feed they were actually applying to the fish. We asked them to feed to cessation, but not feed beyond that. In other words, we were asking them not to waste any feed just because the calculation said that that's what the fish should be eating that particular week. And as you can see, in 2016, we were well below that horizontal dashed line there, which is, again, our discharge allocation. And we've maintained that since then. In addition to the changes in the feeding practices, we also switched to a lower phosphorus feed. And again, that made a substantial difference in our discharge allocation. The only other really important piece of data on this graph are the little yellow horizontal lines that represent our flow. And you'll see that they're decreasing as the x-axis crosses to the right of this graph, down to a level of 3,961 GPM. What we were doing, in addition to managing our feed, is we were managing our flows, trying to fine-tune an optimum flow for these fish that maintained both fish health and helped meet our discharge allocations. The installation of a flow meter in 2018 really helped us with that. That's when we had our largest drop in flow. Next slide, please. So what we have here is background phosphorus data and our net contribution. So the bottom, the orange bars there, represent how much phosphorus is actually in the background water. Again, that's water coming into our pond before we have any impact on it. And you'll see on the far right-hand side there, the last two vertical bars, they rise up and beyond that dark black line that says 0.5 pounds per day. Those 2 weeks, the background data actually exceeds our discharge allocation. So had we not been able to eliminate that from our allocation, just our background water would have been outside of our allocation. We would have had to mitigate for that. Fortunately, we were able to eliminate that from our concentration. And the top blue bars there show our net contribution of discharge. And the top horizontal bar there is our estimated TMDL. Again, that's our discharge based at our flow. We are well below our discharge now and have been again since 2016. And in doing this, we witnessed a pretty interesting phenomenon, which I've highlighted in the oval on the far right there. It says less than 0.0. How's that possible? Well, the reason that's possible is because fish, like all biological organisms, require an uptake of phosphorus for cellular balance, just like you and I do. We quit feeding these fish in the last 2 weeks of the month of April to encourage volitional releasing and to get those fish heading out to the ocean. If there's nothing to eat, the hope is that they're going to go and find something, and that's exactly what they do. As soon as we stop feeding them, they start heading to the ocean. But what we're also doing is we are no longer contributing any phosphorus to that pond, and those fish that are still in the pond require some phosphorus. So through their normal digestive processes, they are actually absorbing some of the phosphorus from that water, giving us a net negative phosphorus contribution that you can see there. Next slide, please. So once we knew we could meet our allocation, the job was to go ahead and put some equipment in there that would allow us to collect those samples automatically rather than with staff. And the picture on the left-hand side there shows one of the two instruments that we put in place. We have one right here at the canal, which is the one that's pictured. That is our incoming water. And then we have one at the outfall of our acclimation pond. We measure weekly for 1 hour every day. It's a 24-hour sample. So on the hour for 24 hours, one day a week, we collect a sample, and it's a composite sample. We empty that, take that to the lab, and they provide us with our results, which are then sent to the Department of Ecology on a monthly basis to show our adherence to the discharge allocation. For the 2012 to 2020 data monitoring, we spent $286,626 roughly in contracted services. Our capital improvement costs, which are the water quality samplers, one of which is pictured here, our total cost was $54,276 for a total of $340,902. And because this pond is shared with Grant County PUD, they actually pick up 36% of this total cost. So our 64%. Our ongoing annual water quality monitoring expenses to run these samples through the lab is about $750. So all in all, the project cost was relatively inexpensive compared to what it could have been had we had to have accounted for that background phosphorus at the same time. At this point, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Commissioners, any questions?
I just have a comment.
Go ahead, McKishan. Okay. First Steve McKenna, then Ann Gongden.
Ian, thanks. That's pretty fascinating data as I look at that. Can you go back and just clarify something for me? Of the $750 for testing, is that a test that's done daily by an outside contractor?
It's not actually daily. What we do is on a weekly basis, we will collect those samples. This is our fish hatchery operators, WDFW contractors, mm-hmm. is who it actually is. They collect those samples and they run them down to a local lab in Wenatchee, Cascade Analytical. Cascade Analytical mm-hmm. runs those samples, and that is what the cost of that $750 annually covers.
It's pretty low cost. That just surprised me. So thank you.
Yeah, I guess it's important to note one of the reasons why it is low cost is because we only operate this pond between the middle of March and the end of April. Oh, so it's about a 6-week yeah. program.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Commissioner Congdon.
Thank you. Yeah, so Ian, great. Great job, good presentation. That's interesting that somewhere along the line they changed the rules and we don't have to include the background phosphorus levels. Was that just a lot of how did that happen? I mean, it makes sense because we, you know, it kind of doesn't matter so much how you get there, but we meet that criteria at the end. But how did that happen? How did
that was through
come about to do that? Go ahead. Sorry.
That was through a lot of communication with various folks at the Department of Ecology and staff here at the district. And one of our primary arguments was that the addendum to the original TMDL literally says in it that, let me pull this up here and I'll read it to you. It said, I'm not seeing the sentence right off the top of my head on this several pages in it, but basically what it says is that the Wenatchee River watershed can handle an additional 743 grams per day of phosphorus. So with that said, that basically gives us our window of allowable discharge up to 743 grams per day. So since they said that it would, that the background, the existing conditions would allow us to still contribute that 743 grams per day without an impact, an additional impact to the Wenatchee River, we could eliminate that background data.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I love to hear that because that means they're listening to you guys, and you're the experts. And so that's just wonderful to hear that you guys have that kind of relationship and that they're listening to the experts and, you know, and responding. Oh, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Randy, I have one. There were some similar concerns expressed about the phosphorus in Lake Wenatchee and the that perpetuating the level of phosphorus, a lot of algae growth. And it was, I think, questionable whether the it was blamed on our fish pens that were in Lake Wenatchee. And part of it, I think the response was that there was a natural flow of phosphorus from the surrounding environment into Lake Wenatchee. You know, has that ever been mitigated, or, you know, what was the resolution on that, if you have any background on that?
I'm sorry, I actually don't have any background on the phosphorus contributions related to that net pen or what might be coming down from the White River.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, because it was an issue for a while, and then it just kind of went away. And I don't know what caused it to go away, but I'm kind of happy it's not an issue right now.
Commissioner Bowles, this is Aline. We actually did, when those net pens were in use, we did do some water quality sampling to essentially debunk the theory that they were coming from our net pens. We took a lot of grab samples while the fish were there. And it was shown that what we were getting in the grab samples we did before and after the net pens or the fish were in the net pens, there was no material difference in the level of phosphorus in the lake. So that's when it was attributed to other sources in the lake. Once we pulled out of those net pens, you know, several years ago now, we haven't done any additional work. But I can say that when Ecology looked at the TMDL for the Wenatchee River, you know, they didn't include a specific TMDL for that upper portion of the river coming from the lake. So, you know, they've done some further work there, but we haven't.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
No problem.
So, any other questions for anybody in the presentation? Good presentation, all three of you. Thank you. It's good to have that update, even though it's not what we would normally say a huge dollar part of what we do. It's a huge psychological part of what we do, is our management of our natural resources. And I think all of us are rightfully proud that we have a team that is willing to commit themselves to us being the good stewards that we like to envision ourselves to be. So thank you, Aline and Ian and Catherine. And back to Steve.
Great. So next up, we're going to do a parks update. Ryan Baker and Kyle Endeman will be making these presentations.
Hey, good morning, commissioners. Can you hear us okay?
Hear you good.
Yes. Awesome. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Ryan Baker, and I'm the Parks Manager. With me is Kyle Endelman, our North End Park Superintendent. Next slide, please. We're here to talk to you today about a parks update. It's been quite some time since we've been in front of the commission, so we wanted to hear some projects that we completed in 2020, as well as what we're up to with projects in 2021. On top of that, we wanted to kind of give you a heads up on other things that are happening in the parks and the opening status. So there is no board action requested today. Next slide, please. All right, let's start with park opening status. So we're very happy to report that our playgrounds are open, particularly Walla Walla Point Park opened last week. We added some sanitation stations out there, so we're hoping to see some of those kiddos join us out in the parks. We're looking to open up our shelter in March when the freeze and thaw stops and get the water back in those shelters. And then our ball fields in April. Of course, we're looking at the governor's guidelines and the amount of people that are gathering in those areas, but we'll be ready to go in April. Heading up north to BB Bridge, we hope to open the campground up there in April as well. If you've been by Walla Walla Point Park lately, you probably noticed that it is being used for a staging area for vehicles for folks getting their vaccinations at the TTC. And I know Tracy Yunt's going to cover more in detail what that has to do with. So next slide, please. All right, let's jump right into it. Let's talk about major maintenance and spending and the major maintenance plan. So a reminder, in our 15 parks, we see about 3 million visitors a year. I think last year was a lot more than that, but that's about the average. Speaking of average, our O&M and capital comes in at about 8 million on an annual basis, and that's an average between 2020 and 2024. The breakdown is 6 million with O&M and approximately 2 million on the capital side of things. And if you look at the percentages down below that number, that's kind of the breakdown with expenditures by pool. We basically track all of our assets, we monitor them, and we inspect them, and that's what we add into our five-year plan for spending. As you would note, the boat launches, docks, mortgages, and erosion projects are the most expensive of the overall costs. Next slide, please. Speaking of docks and launches, you'll notice the graph on the right there, quite the drop after 2020. We had a 10-year trend of replacing lots of pieces and bits on our docks, anywhere from the piling to the floats to some of the launches. The new life expectancy with our launches is 50 years, where we saw roughly 25 to 30 years out of our initial launches. And that's just, you know, newer technology and just better things we're putting out there. So next slide, please. All right, let's head on up north to Lake Chelan. If you look at the before and after photos in the slide, they don't look completely different, but what we did up there is we actually removed the old wooden docks and floats, replaced with brand new floats. We encased the piling out there, and that just increases the life expectancy of the pile. And then probably more importantly, we added brand new connection points to the wave break, which is at the bottom of your screen there. We had some issues with them breaking off, and they're filled with concrete, and we want to make sure those stay put, and those help with boating when the seas get rough out there on the water. So very happy to get that project done. Shout out to Court Hill for his great job of overseeing that project. Next slide, please. All right, speaking of docks, we are looking at BB Bridge there. The before photo is a picture of our older style dock. They have the foam-filled tires and the old wood structure. They were not all that great if you ever had to moor your boat there, because if you look at the after shot, you'll see we reconfigured the dock system there to run parallel with the flow of the water. And as a boater, as you know, if you pull up to that dock, it's a lot easier to go ahead and moor. And then, of course, being in the campground there, it's nice not to pull your boat out, you know, every day. You can kind of leave that tied up and camp with us. So not only did we complete BB Bridge, we also completed Chelan Falls and ENIAC Park. So all three of those parks received brand new mortgage docks in 2020. Next slide, please. All right, let's jump down south and talk a little bit about the Confluence State Park area. The before photo is a photo of the shoreline where you can see it was really starting to eat back into the turf there. The light post in the background there is actually the Apple Capital Loop Trail, so it was in danger of taking the trail there. And if you look at the after shot, you'll notice that we did a really great job at armoring the shoreline there, and hopefully we'll keep that erosion from marching forward. So really happy to get that project done in 2020. Next slide, please. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle to talk a little bit about the fiber service that we brought into Beebe.
Good morning, commissioners. I have a couple projects to share with you, starting with bringing fiber into Beebe Bridge Park. Prior to this install, which happened last spring, we had pretty slow and somewhat unreliable internet service up at the park. With the install of fiber, this allowed us to increase the number of security cameras that are up there to give security a little bit better view of what's going on. We are also running an irrigation pilot program up at Beebe Park, and this is a web-based irrigation system. Should we decide to use this in the future, we'll rely on Wi-Fi and internet service. We also now have the potential to bring Wi-Fi to campers at the campground, should we choose to do so in the future. Next slide, please. Another project we have slated for 2021 is tennis court resurfacing and repainting and striping. So we have two parks that we're going to focus on this year, Walla Walla Park and Daroga Park. And not only will we be resurfacing and patching cracks and holes, but we'll also be repainting. And while we do that, we're going to restripe them for pickleball. Pickleball has gained in popularity in recent years, and we've got a lot of requests to do a pickleball court. So as we move forward, we're going to restripe our courts to accommodate pickleball as well. Next slide, please. Another project here is Kirby Billingsley Erosion Control Project. This project we actually paused for a little while. We wanted to monitor our design to see if it could handle the fluctuating flows brought on by TDIP. It turns out, good news, it does. So we were able to utilize our original design, which is helpful. And we will start this project in October. As you can see from the picture here, erosion has got quite a bit of erosion there. In fact, we had to remove a couple benches, picnic table, out of that area, and it is encroaching on our trail there. So good timing to get that done. Should start around October, finish up end of the fall into winter, and it'll run about $1.1 million. Next slide, please. This slide depicts our trail counter that we installed at Linden Tree on the Loop Trail. As you can see, we installed this in July of 2019, partway through the month. So July is not a real accurate depiction of the increase in numbers, but you can kind of see our huge numbers that we had last year. Upwards of 40 to 50,000 people per month going by that particular spot in the park. And it should kind of be noted that we saw, a lot of increased customers throughout our park system last year, largely due to COVID and, people looking for things to do. Next slide, please. Wanted to give you a quick park rules update, but before I do that, I'd like to have you take a look at the upper left-hand corner of the screen there. That is roughly the area of the Reach One Trail, and wanted to briefly let you know that we are doing a trail extension there in partnership with the Chelan Trails Alliance and the City of Chelan. The PUD provided basically the property and permitted, and then the Chelan Trail Alliance is doing the work there to extend that trail, and they will be incurring all the construction costs and the maintenance on that trail piece there. So a couple of rule updates. We had to tweak a few of our rules. Those included drone policy and electric motorcycles. We have also updated our lost and found guideline, and our metal detecting policy we updated to align more closely with state parks. We also, due to increased court use this year, some of our busiest tennis courts, we have installed signs to limit play, so that gives more people opportunity to play on those courts. Oh, for camping, quite a few updates here. We'll go quickly, but we are going to be switching over to a reservation system. The campground up at Beebe has outgrown its first come, first serve policy that we've had for a while. And we will be going live with this at the end of March, and camping will begin on April 1st this year. A couple rules we had to change just to kind of align with the new system we had. And we did need to tweak the fees a little bit. We will increase our fees both off-season and peak season by $5 a night. And this is to help cover the cost of managing the reservation system. We have reservation fees now, so this will kind of offset some of that cost. However, we will be offering senior discounts year-round starting now. So before, we had give seniors discounts in the off-season, so spring and fall. We'll be continuing that throughout the season. And that'll change from a standard $5 a night to a 20% discount. Next slide, please. So in summary, the park staff did a great job this year. They had a tough time with COVID, obviously, in the beginning of spring last year. A lot of new stuff happening. We saw just huge visitor numbers. Kind of threw us for a loop a little bit there, but we were able to manage and keep our park system open and operating. We are on track with O&M and capital project spending for boat docks, boat launches, and erosion control projects. And the reservation system at Beebe is happening. We'll go live later in March with the camping starting on April 1st. This should improve customer experience and safety and reduce staff time in kind of managing the problems that came with first come, first serve. And another reminder, 2021 is trending to be another very busy year. We're still seeing some COVID-related increases in our customers. And with that, I'll open it up to any questions you have.
I have a question. With respect to the reservation system at Beebe, how does that work? What number are they going to call?
Yes, so this will be, it is a web-based system, so it'll be similar to what State Parks is. So you'll go to our website. There will be a link that takes you in. There'll be a calendar. There'll be a map of our campground. You can pick the nights that you want. You can see immediately if there's any availability for that site. So we're hoping to allow people to take a look before they come, so they don't have to just come over and then to the park and then find out that there's 20 people ahead of them in line and they can't get a spot.
Will there be a change in the number of days that are limited for camping?
Yes, a slight change. So currently we allow 10 days in a row. We will stick with that, but our number of days per year camp there are going to switch to 21. This is a bit of an adjustment, but what we found was we were having people basically living in the campground over summer, and we want to have the campground available for recreational use. We're not really set up to handle people being there 3 or 4 months a year.
Thank you.
I've got a question. This is Steve McKenna. Thanks, guys. That was a great presentation. It's good to hear about our reservation system getting online. I know you've been working on that for quite a while, so I really appreciate your efforts on that. And I think that's going to make I think it's going to be much better for the public to know for sure that they've got a spot, it's reserved. They can make their plans. At one point, and this is kind of I need to refresh my memory. Did we have some free camping or something that we were going to do there for Chelan County customers?
Yeah, a great question. So a few years back, Commissioner McKenna, we did the pilot program through the Public Power Benefit. And what we asked the commission was if we could pause with that program until we had an opportunity to implement the reservation system. We want to make sure that things are running smoothly and that we have things under control. We'd like to get a year under our belt, and then after that, hopefully
we'll be able to come back and implement that afterwards.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then, Kyle, I had one question. You said something that I so with the bringing in the fiber optic to the park up there, I didn't quite understand if we decide to offer Wi-Fi for the customers. Can you catch me up on that, or
yes,
are we not offering that at first?
No, we're not offering Wi-Fi for our campers, but that is a request that we get, one of our frequent requests that we get throughout the year. A lot of campgrounds are offering internet service. We don't currently offer it, and we don't have any immediate plans to offer it, but it's there. That seems where a lot of the more developed campgrounds are going. So that allows us to do that in the future should we choose to do it.
So how do you make that determination? That just seems like, if we have fiber there and speed is not the option, what's holding us back? I just know that as a commissioner, I hear all the time, you know, when are we going to have access to Wi-Fi? And I know our staff probably are going to be hearing from people up there if they don't have access. So I just don't quite, is that an equipment issue, or what's holding us back from doing that? Or is that just something we want people to camp and not have access and not be on their apparatus? I'm just curious.
That's a great question. I'd love for my family to camp without Wi-Fi, but as things develop and folks are working remotely, what that would take, Commissioner, is we would need to go out and essentially put out an RFP, see who would be interested, make sure we have a competitive process. They would likely need to install infrastructure within the parks. We'd have to decide, what that fee structure looks like. Probably remembering about a year or so ago, we engaged with a local company and then quickly realized there could be some potential gifting issues within that. And so we paused, quite frankly, to focus on the reservation system. To get that implemented. And then I would say that's probably something that will be coming up in the near future. I don't have a specific date for you, but to Kyle's point, we do get folks that are, letting us know they'd like to see that. So I think it's just a matter of priorities and a matter of time and just kind of getting around to it. But, when we get that on the list, we can certainly share with you, what that date looks like.
And I might say also, I was going to say, it might also, another criteria will be money. So it's not clear there's a business case for it. So there'll be a question there as to what it will cost that we would probably need to engage as well.
Yep. Good point.
I have comment and related question. Several years back when Carmen Bergman was a commissioner, we met with Steve King from the city, ownership from the Riverside 9 Apartments and Management related to and Jeff Smith from the PUD, what ultimately resulted in the fence along the Riverside 9 Apartments, separating the apartments from the trail. And the issue was the occupants of the apartments seemed to be just simply letting their dogs out. And the dogs then created a fecal depository problem on Schlenk County PUD Parks property. That same concern has been surfaced to me again recently by some of our park users that they appreciate the efforts of our park employees in policing the residue from the dogs, on our property, but are saying, why are the apartment people not being held accountable any longer for what appears to be the release of their dogs through the gates and just down to utilize park property. So again, public relations issue. you know, and is there an awareness of that? And if so, you know, what are we doing about it? Or is there something we should be doing something about? So there's my dog question for the day.
Good dog question. And yes, you're probably remembering a few years back, we did see that development, and we did see some of those challenges. And so our response was to reach out to the folks managing Riverside 9 and other areas that are adjacent to the park. We try to develop a relationship where we can engage them if we're seeing issues. So we talk to them on a regular basis, and we send out emails and reminders to folks that live in those complexes. In addition to that, Commissioner, we added two specific areas outside of R9 for folks to use for dog facilities. They also added some additional receptacles on their end as far as bags. And then I would say the last thing that we've done is we've engaged our security department. And I see on a regular basis we get guard reports, and I see a lot of contacts being made, educational contacts, reminders. You know, the main issue for us can be dog off leash and, you know, approaching other folks. So I would say those are probably the primary things that we have done, not just at Riverside 9, quite frankly, but as the riverfront develops with hotels, motels, and other areas. So, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And part of my concern is that, you know, shortly there's going to be, what, I think another 450 units in the Columbia Cloister area, you know, and if it's an issue now, it's not going to get smaller. So, yeah, I appreciate your efforts and, you know, report back to the complainant party that brought the issue to me. But I just think that in terms of public relation that we need to maintain our vigilance there and the quality of what we offer to our public. But thank you very much.
Agree. Thank you.
Guys, thanks for the presentation. I think Randy has left, and Steve, we're on to number 5, I believe.
Actually, I have one quick question before we go, if I can. So I want to applaud you for recognizing the growing popularity of pickleball. And I had a number of folks approached me with respect to expansion of pickleball facilities, so I'm really pleased that we're taking some steps. For clarity, will the tennis courts be converted to pickleball courts, or will they be dual use? And if they're dual use, the height of the nets are quite different. Will there be some accommodation for that?
They will remain, or they will be dual use courts to kind of maximize, you know, usage. The we've kind of gone back and forth on this, but you know, the net height differs an inch or two, I think, and kind of our stance was that for recreational use it would suffice for now, rather than to try and get, you know, separate facilities for both pickleball and for tennis.
Okay. Thank you. I know that I've had 3 separate folks reach out to me with requests for conversion, actually, of tennis courts to pickleball, simply because tennis seems to be waning and pickleball seems to be increasing. So I appreciate your efforts. And you might want to particularly do a survey of some kind to see. I know I've walked by the tennis court several times during the summer, and they're often not used. But I also remember when I was younger, I played tennis all the time. Maybe that's it. I'm getting older. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you.
No, thank you. And yes, that is a trend we're seeing as pickleball is increasing in popularity. I did want to point out real quickly that all of our courts up in the Chelan area are striped for pickleball as well. So I know that there's a large pickleball population up there. So we'll be monitoring that situation as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Kyle and Ryan, thank you very much for your time and information. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'll turn that back over to you.
Okay, I want to invite Andrew Gassell, Lacey Stockton, and Josh Mitchell up for a report to the board on the low-income program development and how that's coming along.
Great. Thank you, Steve, and good morning, commissioners. This is Andrew Gassell. I manage our customer energy solutions team, and with me, and they can introduce themselves, is Lacey Stockton, Josh, and Josh Mitchell, and they're going to be providing the bulk of the presentation later on. I'm just here to kind of kick off the discussion a little bit. And so we're here to provide you an update and to seek your feedback on our low income and high energy burden program design work that we are in the middle of doing. Next slide. So why are we here? We're here to discuss three important items. First is, at what level should we focus our low income programs? There's all manner of different ways to define low income, to define high energy burden, and so where is it where we should focus our programs? Second, of course, is discuss at what level, at what cost, the level of funds do we want to provide to the program? We know that many low income programs, and they'll get into this a little bit later, do not meet standard cost effectiveness tests, just because the population that we're and the customers that we're trying to reach just simply don't have the funds to add their dollars into the program as well, like such as occurs with our regular current program. We also want to look at income verification options, and this is going to be really important from an administrative burden standpoint and as well as a participation from our customer standpoint, and so we'll have a discussion about that. Finally, it's not up here, but Eric will make a special guest appearance for us, and he's going to provide a summary of the Clean Energy Transformation Act and discuss how that pertains or could pertain to our low-income programs as we move forward. All right, next slide. So this, of course, is a reminder of our threefold program purpose. We want to support our strategic plan, want to meet the goals of the Clean Energy Transformation Act and use those also to help support our strategic plan. And then we want to reduce those things that many of our low-income customers may have, reduce energy insecurity, minimize shutoffs, and especially minimize heat or eat situations. And with that, I will hand it over to Eric, and he will provide an update or a summary of our Clean Energy Transformation Act.
Thank you, Andrew. You'll go to the next slide for me. Thanks. So, commissioners, as Andrew noted, there's been some question here as we're in the implementation process, rulemaking process associated with the Clean Energy Transformation Act and what the implications of that act are on the low-income households and the low-income programs that the district offers. So on this slide four, I've given you a brief summary of the impacts of one section of the Act. 19405120 is the section that addresses low-income households. It does state an overall goal under the Clean Energy Transformation Act of making progress towards energy assistance funding becoming available to low-income households. And there are only really two requirements on utilities like the district that come out of the Act. Now, it's important to remind ourselves that the rules for CEDA are still under development in many areas, and the last rulemake that I reviewed was late December, like December 29th of 2020. Those rules did not implicate the low income. But effectively, the two requirements which are stated there is that utilities must make programs and funding available to low-income households by July 31, 2020. There is a priority preference given to energy-burdened customers. And then the second requirement is that the utilities submit biennially a report to Commerce, effectively telling Commerce what the programs and mechanisms the utility is using to reach out to those low-income customers and households, a description of the strategies that are used to outreach to those customers, and then an assessment of how we are doing as compared to the targets, and they are not mandates, they are targets set out in the Act of meeting 60% of the need by 2030 and 90% of the need for that customer group by 2050. Next slide. So the key takeaways, at least as they relate to the important questions that Andrew and his team have developed and are putting to the board for some input and thinking, effectively, the takeaway is that the board has very broad discretion to answer those questions without any dictate from the Clean Energy Transformation Act. I've given you the four bullets here as they relate to the questions that Andrew has asked. The first is a reminder that we do offer programs and funding presently, both through our conservation programs and rate relief to low income. So we don't have anything immediately that the district needs to do relative to that July 31, 2021 target date. Importantly, the Clean Energy Transformation Act also does not set those specific compliance numbers. We do have to prepare the reporting, which is really designed as a check-in or an assessment of how we're doing in meeting that goal of expanding availability of resource and funding to low-income households. Low-income is not a defined term in the Act. The Commission has, with only the limits given you there in the bullet, complete discretion to define low income, at least as it relates to the Clean Energy Transformation Act requirements, really between zero and either up to 200% of the federal poverty level or 80% of the median household income for our area. And then finally, and that includes how to address and assess verification of low income. And the board will have to make some administrative decisions or provide some guidance as to how we would like to verify that the folks who are seeking program assistance qualify for program assistance measured against how the board defines low income. And finally, as it relates to Andrew's questions of what programs to offer and the cost effectiveness of those programs, those are also within the board's purview and discretion. So that's just a quick summary overview. I'm happy to discuss further with each or any of you and answer any questions. If there aren't any questions, I'll turn it back to Andrew.
I have a question, Eric. This is Gary. Can you tell me what is the federal dollar amount for poverty level?
You know, I can't off my top of my head, but I can tell you that Andrew's team, I think if you give them maybe just one slide, we'll be able to tell you that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, and so Lacey's going to take these next slides, and I don't believe you have met her. She's our new marketing strategist. Her name's Lacey Stockton, and I think this is her first presentation to the board today, and so just a great addition to the team, and let her start discussing sort of the different how we could define low income and at what levels does that look like. Okay, Lacey.
Thanks, Andrew. So yeah, and also thank you, Eric, for the setup. As Eric said, CETA is really focused, at least this portion, on reducing what they're calling energy burden. So energy burden is anyone who pays 6% or more of their income on their energy costs. So this actually aligns pretty well with our strategic plan. We have this goal to reduce the impact of rate increases on customers with low incomes. So kind of a bit of an overlap with the energy burden folks. So which households are we talking about? Well, you're looking at a breakdown of households by income for Chelan County. And you'll notice that there's a green bar. These 2,100 homes have an energy burden of 6% or more. And these homes, most of them have incomes of less than $15,000. All of them have incomes of less than $20,000 a year. So we're talking about a pretty small subset of who might qualify as low income. Not all low income homes have a high energy burden, mainly thanks to our low rates. So what's the difference between these high energy burden folks and more general low income? Next slide, please. So this kind of goes to answer your question of what range of incomes could qualify as low income. Well, there's a lot of definitions. You know, CEDA recommends up to 80% of the area median income, which is on the left there. More commonly in our area, federal poverty limit or a percentage thereof is used. So, you know, our discount programs start at 125% of the federal poverty and go on up to our low-income weatherization program at about 200% of federal poverty. And you'll notice that there's a really wide range between, you know, which marker you're using and household size. You could get up to some larger households well above our area median income. So while all households with a high energy burden we saw would probably, no matter what the metric here, they'd probably qualify as low income, not all low income homes have a high energy burden. So it's really this energy burden piece is pairing ultra low incomes with relatively high energy bills. Next slide. Okay, so as Eric mentioned, we do meet the program requirements of offering programs to low income. So if we were to consider our total pie of about 10,000 homes in Chelan County who could potentially qualify as low income, right now many could be eligible for our discounts, so that orange slice for our low income seniors and folks with disabilities. And we're also starting our new low income programs in Q2, that green slice. But why wouldn't we just build a program for the entire pie? Well, I think this brings us back to our business goal, which is reducing the impacts of rate increases on customers who are most affected by them, or as CEDA puts it, reducing energy burden. And really the most cost-effective way to do this and to show progress towards reducing energy burden is to run targeted programs that are specifically focused at reducing energy burden to below 6%, not necessarily targeting all low-income households the same. I mean, alternatively, we could allot even millions to a general low-income program, but without targeting reducing energy burden, we're not necessarily meeting the biggest need in our community, and we won't necessarily be able to show as much progress towards meeting goals for CEDA. So next slide. This brings us to our recommendation. You know, both CEDA and our strategic plan, they highlight this fact that is rates increase, the impact is not proportionate. So we'd really like to focus Chelan PUD resources on these green folks, these high energy burden customers, with the goal of reducing this need over 6% of incomes. And from the more generally categorized low-income households, we're exploring external funding to increase participation of, you know, low-income customers with a low energy burden into our standard energy efficiency programs. And we wanted to run this by you and hear what you think about really focusing on these households with a high energy burden over a more global low-income program.
Lacey, I'll tell you what, let's take questions from the board at the end of your presentation and so they can see the whole thing.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm going to then pass it on to Josh Mitchell. He is our residential energy advisor, and he's going to talk a little bit more about programs and what they could look like if they were focused specifically on high energy burden customers. Josh?
Are you on mute, Josh?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that. Good morning, commissioners. I realize Lacey has presented a lot of information to you, and there's a lot to digest, and I'm here to look for direction from you regarding funding and verification of participants to this, to the program. Energy burden is a distribution. Many homes need a little bit of help to make their electric bills affordable, and other homes need deep retrofits and also potentially financial energy assistance that we provide. to reduce their energy burden. Either way, these customers who fall into this distribution means that they're making, as Lacey said, close to $15,000 each year. And asking them to participate in any funding level would essentially drop the participation rate to zero. Next slide. So to align our programs with the varying assistance and home needs, we intend to design different tiers of programs to layer on top of each other. From a light touch, low cost, and modest bill savings program that allows us to build a relationship with customers who are traditionally hard to reach, to a medium touch program that includes window and insulation measures, as well as appliance replacement. This comes with more bill savings and will require an additional investment. And then the expanded program is where it's the deepest benefit and it provides the greatest savings to those customers on the far right of the distribution of the high energy burden homes. Next slide. This is kind of the meat and potatoes slide. It shows the time frame that we're talking about, the expected number of customers reached through each tier, and the annual savings, as well as the additional cost beyond what we have run with our cost-effective incentives, which tend to be covered by the wholesale market benefits of our savings. So, for example, our light touch program is something that we are currently funding, where we're working with 700 homes a year, for up to 2,100 homes, where it's a direct install, or, you know, during COVID, we're likely doing mail of different low-cost measures. The medium program, which will run 8 to 10 years, has a large incremental cost of close to $620,000 per year, but a lot of energy savings that go along with that program. And then the expanded program, which would be 6 to 8 years, has an additional cost of $255,000 per year, where you're hitting those toughest customer or the customers with the most amount of energy burden, with about 60 to 80 homes per year targeting a 12% overall savings goal of our residential portfolio. Next slide, please. So we're looking at, on average, well, for the light program, it's $180,000 to invest in that program over the lifespan of the program. It's a large investment on that weatherization. We know windows and insulation and appliances can be expensive, but can provide us with a large amount of efficiency gains. And then the expanded program, over the life of that program, is about $1.5 million. So each year we're looking for, you know, for the light and medium, it would be about $565,000 on average over the next 9 years to fund. And then for all the tiers, it would be close to $735,000 on average over the next 9 years. Next slide, please. So in order to continue to design our programs to help customers who have unsustainable electric bills, and to continue to design programs to support that goal, can we expect public power benefits to help with this? So beyond current program funding levels, the PPB investment could be between $200,000 and up to $725,000 annually, which can help us reduce our rate increase impacts on our most impacted customers and also support our CETA targets. Next slide. The second piece of this that I'm talking about is for our low-income programs, we need to figure out how we want to verify that these customers are that are participating in these programs really need the help. So we intend to target our marketing to specific areas in the community that have been pointed out as a heavy concentration of high energy burden customers through our low-income needs assessment that we commissioned last year. And there are essentially two ways to do that. One is where we have individuals apply by bringing in their low-income statements to the Community Action Council, which would add an expense to us, as well as a huge hurdle, to these customers. But we'll provide a great certainty that these customers meet the eligibility. To remove the high cost and administrative burden, as well as removing that hurdle of having these customers set up an appointment, we are recommending a self-declaration program where we cross-reference with our internal sources, like our customer relations team, or our external groups, like our Community Action Council, and do spot verifications. We've done some peer reviews on utilities that offer this option, and both participation goes up and the evaluations of the program show very little evading of program requirements. Next slide. So we are recommending that the use of self-declarations with verification audits to ensure customers are able to easily participate but not game the system. Next slide. So the plan from here is to take the board feedback and continue to design these programs. We want to continue to meet with key customer stakeholders, which we've had one advisory committee already, and they're very supportive and excited that the PUD is taking steps to reduce energy burden customers. And then we plan to continue to work through this low-income rental market question and look for outside funding to assist with these programs. And we intend to return to the board on April 5th for the next update. And at this point, I guess the whole team will take questions.
Let me just summarize real quickly. So there are two areas here where we're making recommendations, the eligibility for the program and the self-declaration as a means for validating income. And so we want to test and see if you're comfortable with those. And then an area that we're really just trying to get a sense of where you are is the potential cost of this program, recognizing that this would come out of public power benefit dollars. So we have the $6 million per year that the board has allocated for that. So the range that we're looking at is that $200,000 to $700,000 per year. Obviously, get more savings, but at more cost. And so not expecting you to come up with a dollar number, but just trying to get a sense of how you approach this. And do you have any further questions for us that would help you to make a decision about where we should land?
Commissioners, do you have any questions? May we return to slide number 11 for a moment, please? Okay, in this category of customer, I don't know if we've isolated this specifically, but what is their average monthly bill?
It's about $700.
Monthly bill?
Oh, sorry, that's annual.
Okay, so we're looking at approximately $60 a month, correct?
Yes.
Okay. When I look at light, the current one, the modest bill saving is 1 to 5%. So, quick math, let's say the average bill is $60. 1 to 5% is what, maximum $3 a month savings? Am I doing this right? And then medium, 5 to 10%, expanded, 10 to 40%. And I guess the question I'm raising, looking at the percentage of saving for the customer, is that when you look at the light or the medium, it's almost, gosh, and I want to say this skillfully, but is it worth the total investment that we're making in this whole process for $3 to $6 a month on the light and the medium? What is that a significant enough value to warrant the expenditure and the effort and the tracking and the diligence? But then on the other hand, if I'm that customer, how important is $3 to $6 a month? So that's kind of my range of question in there. I hope that makes sense the way I've expressed it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to go ahead and say yes, absolutely, the way you're thinking about it. I do want to clarify, though, that the light program is noted as cost effective under there. And what that means is similar to our current or more market-based energy efficiency programs, that one actually is being beneficial to all customers. And so it's
okay.
So the light one, that's why we're kind of moving forward with that one anyways, because we've done the numbers, we've done the benefit cost ratio, that one's plus, on the plus side for us. And so it's really these next two levels that are up, and your math is right on the dollars per month. And so from a strictly financial perspective on some of them, there's a lot of work to be done to help the customer save, To us, a small amount of money. I can't answer for them. But then again, we were also looking at improving the housing stock. So these are things that are long-term benefits across across low-income housing stock, for many, many years. If you're looking at windows and heating and cooling, 25 years, windows, 45 years. But so there's comfort, there's also the comfort, health, and safety sort of components too, which aren't easily...
Yeah.
Those aren't easily put into the benefit cost ratio. And so I just wanted to kind of bring those up as well you're right, small numbers, a lot of effort, does that make sense from a financial perspective? That's for, I think, the board to wrestle with. There are these other benefits that are beneficial. What kind of value do we put on those? That's hard to say.
Yeah.
Does that help?
I appreciate your perspective on that. The other piece of it is, if we move more into the expanded, and we have a cross savings in terms of our energy expenditure to those customers, and then we turn around and sell that power on the open market, is that calculated into the, let's say, maximum cost of $750,000. Is that part of that, or is it deducted from it?
That is the amount. So when we calculated that, we took it down to basically a 1.0 benefit cost, and that's the amount above, beyond that, which is needed to actually fund the program.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate your perspective.
Yep. So that's incremental to the... So we do make up, if we go into a home and we spend X amount of money on the home and we go into it, we recover some of it, but still that piece, let's use the $700,000 number you used, that is fully incremental above that. And that is why we would look at it as something that maybe public power benefit could fund, because it's something that's, it's not similar to our other energy efficiency programs at that point.
Okay, and then one last comment, and then I'll get out of the way. If we are serious about our commitment, as a as an organization to improving the quality of life in Cheyenne County. And I look at the expanded version. If you have a person of poverty who is getting up every day and going to work at a job that yields $15,000 to $20,000 a year, and there's the potential of helping to create a more comfortable living environment for that person, you know, and their family, does that not fit into the definition of improving the quality of life in Chelan County? And I think that's more of a philosophical statement than a financial one, but, you know, that's one of my thoughts. So thanks for your diligence and your patience.
You're welcome. That's why we brought it, you know, we're bringing these questions to the board to help, for you to help guide us as we try to design programs that, you know, meet your expectations.
Any other questions? From my stand, oh, Gary, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just curious with the $15,000 to $20,000 annual income, there's a high likelihood that we're not necessarily talking about somebody that owns a home, more likely a renter. And so now we shift to the benefit of a landlord. And yes, I understand the benefit to the person living in that particular home. Where I'm a little unclear is how that passes through from a renter to a landlord. And I know we're trying to take a look at federal poverty level for being able to apply. Can you kind of give me your thought on how this process would work in your mind's eye?
I think that is a question that we're continuing to struggle with. As you noted on our last slide, we have renter and landowner work that still needs to be done, because that is a great question. And so, you know, the one of the things we could do is, you know, if there is, you know, we could go through the data and look for landowner, and we could, you know, I think you're right, there a majority of the folks that fall on this range. And Lacey, do you have data on that?
For our high energy burden folks, we're looking at about 70 to 80% are renters.
So I think what we would do to first, while we're still trying to figure out the rentals thing, is we could target those that are homeowners that maybe have, you know, homes that they haven't been able to, you know, keep up for whatever reason, whatever the reason may be. As far as, we still do need to do some additional work on the landowner landlord versus renter question, because of what you're talking about there. And that's a hard one. I mean, it is, you know, you're benefiting property, but, you know, of someone who has the property, but then you're also benefiting the person that's living there. And, you know, how do we balance that, I guess? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, no, I agree. And thank you. I think, you know, I really, just to let you know where I'm coming from, I'm a supporter of what I have heard today and what I have read. It's just trying to get my arms around how this might take shape. So I like the path, personally. I like the path you're on. I guess it's just, as you're pointing out, just several more questions that we need to take a look at.
We do know that there are about 600 HUD housing units in Chelan County, and that's a good place to start, where most of those are low-income, high energy burden homes we can anticipate. So that's a good way to start with the rental question.
This is Steve McKenna. I appreciate the question on the eligibility that comes forward, because that really becomes a burden for staff. And having worked in organizations that are constantly working on eligibility for student lunches, et cetera, who qualifies for what program, I would just let you know I'm supportive of the direction you're heading there with determining eligibility, auditing it, and then if you find that through those audits that the work is, people are being accurate and truthful, and you continue that and let off the gas pedal, and when that starts to fall apart, then you push the gas pedal back down and crank it up a little bit. But that's a tough one, so I appreciate the sensitivity to that and the efforts. Okay, do we have any other questions? Andrew, Josh, Eric, good seeing you. And then Lacey, this is a nice way to, kind of a nice way to meet you. We at least get to see you, and hopefully in the future get to meet you in person. So thank you for all your work, team. And Steve, I'll turn that over to you.
Okay. Commissioner McKenna, can I just do one more quick check? I heard support for the verification program. The focus on the energy burden customers, just because there were no comments, I'm going to assume that there's board comfort with that, unless I hear otherwise. I'll just pause for a moment to make sure that's okay. Good. Okay, great. Thank you.
Steve, this is Ann. Yeah, support here to continue to look at this, but you know, you will be back, right? And income verification, exactly who we deal with, energy burden. I understand what that means, but you know, the level of the investment of the PUD. I mean, quality of life for all of our customers is one of our, you know, that's right in our mission and our vision statement. So, you know, I just want to make sure that I understand and that we all understand exactly what we're doing and who's benefiting, and then we'll have to sell this to all of our customers out there.
I think we heard some good questions today, and you know, we tried to describe, we don't feel like we're at the end of this process. We're really at best in the middle of the process, so trying to learn it about it, and so we will be coming back for more conversation, try to advance it based on the comments that we've heard here today. Okay. We really are too late to start the next presentation. So, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. I had one more thing that I had asked Eric to do before we move on. Please, Eric.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Commissioners, last meeting we had some guests from the Chelan Valley Housing Trust. You'll recall the presentation that they made, and near the end of that particular conversation, one of the commissioners, I think it was Commissioner McKenna, had asked for some follow-up information on the district's ability to waive connection charges for folks that would be buying those homes from from that entity. And whether or not we could do that. So the answer to the question, commissioners, is yes, we can. There is a specific statute or portion thereof in Title 54 that allows the board to choose to waive connection charges for properties that are purchased by low-income persons from organizations like the Chelan Valley Housing Trust that are tax-exempt under 501c3 of the federal code. Interestingly, I learned while we were putting the answer to that question in concrete that your predecessors back in 1995 actually adopted a resolution authorizing that and amended that resolution in 1999 to establish those individuals that would be qualified for those connection waivers to be purchasers making less than 150% of the federal poverty level. That has not been updated in any fashion that I can find since 1999. But it does dovetail a bit into this particular conversation that you've been having with Andrew and his team, associated with low income. So this seemed like a good time to follow up on that question. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to try to answer them now or in the future.
Great. Thank you, Eric, for getting back to us on that. Steve, how would you like to proceed?
Let me just do a quick add to that. Based on Eric's research and the response we got from the board last time, we will be putting together something that give you a sense of what it might cost to do a reduction in fees for that low-income housing and bring that back to the board and see your level of interest in pursuing a program like that. Does that seem right?
So,
yeah.
Yes. So may I jump in here, Steve? You said a reduction in fees. Eric, you talked about a complete waiver of fees, so I hope that's something that we will come before us, that decision.
I think that that decision and the level of assistance is within your discretion. So, yes, it would be a good topic for you guys to be thinking about.
And we can
But clearly it's not a gifting of either waiver or reduction of, particularly reduction of fees wouldn't be a gifting issue.
So there, it is not a gifting issue because, I'm sorry, Commissioner. It would not be a gifting issue because it is expressly authorized by statute.
Okay. Thank you.
And so based on that comment, we will just bring back a range of what the board could do. That would be some reduction all the way to full waiver and it give you a sense of what the annual cost of that will be, and it'll be your choice as to where, how far you want to go.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we've hit noon. We didn't make it through our morning session. I was concerned we might not, to be honest, when I saw the agenda. And we had a very active board today, which is always great. Happy to have your questions. So I would propose that we do is pick up the item that we didn't finish this morning, first thing this afternoon, just because we've had staff that are ready to go on that. We can get them through their presentation, and then we just have one agenda item and some manager items for this afternoon beyond that.
Great. To follow the directives of Randy before he left, he wanted to offer the opportunity for any public comment before we close up for lunch. I want to do that at this time. If there was anything from the public that would like to address the commission. Okay,
I was going to say, we are expecting one public commenter, and we invited them to come in roughly around 1:30 today, thinking that that's where it would fit on the agenda.
Great. Okay, so we will be back at 1 p.m. this afternoon to finish up item number 6 and then move in to the rest of our business. We'll stand adjourned. Good afternoon. We are back in session with for our business session of the Chelan Public Utility Commissioners, March 1st, 2021. We welcome the involvement of our public, and we will provide opportunities for you to speak to items on the agenda or anything else you'd like to visit with the commissioners. Is there anybody in the public present that would like to address the commission? I'll be checking on that a little later. So I'll turn this over to Steve. Steve Wright.
Okay, we had one item that we didn't get to this morning we'd like to pick up this afternoon. That's the public safety outage management presentation. Rachel Hansen, Chad Bellman, and Chad Brisman will be making this presentation.
Hi, welcome back, commissioners. Can I get a thumbs up if you hear me? Thumbs up. Okay, good. So as Chelan County residents, we've been living with fire for a long time. We've organized FireWise communities. We have prescribed burns. We have burn bans, and that is all seasonal and expected. But after the events we saw over Labor Day weekend, it's time to start a conversation about a kind of outage that's specific to extreme wildfire conditions. And it's not an easy conversation for us to have. I mean, we're the PUD. Our crews are the ones that go out in an ice storm in the middle of the night to restore power to our customer. Our staff here have dedicated their careers to ensuring reliability. But the risks to our communities and the risk to our utility have grown so catastrophic that we need to do our due diligence in exploring this option. Next slide. So today, we're going to share with you some data and some case studies that prompted the need for this option. And we're going to ask the board for a head nod to develop this plan further with our emergency response partners and our telecom agencies. We'll be back in April to show you what we found. And then, we'll look for your blessing to go out to the impacted community for some public outreach. And we'll gather those comments and come back to you in June to discuss what we found and the concerns that we heard. And we'll decide, you guys will decide where to go from there. So next slide, moving on to situational awareness. So as you know, we have a comprehensive wildfire program already for years now, and we continue to build upon that. However, there are several risk factors that are outside of our control, including more extreme fire weather and fire behavior. We're seeing more recreation and development in fire-prone areas. The clearance that we have for tree trimming is limited, especially on Forest Service land. We're hearing through studies from the Forest Service and DNR that forest health continues to decline for a variety of reasons. And we're seeing a legal precedent starting to form through case studies from California and Oregon. Moving on to the next slide. So we'll take a minute talking about this case studies. In California, the utilities have had the authority to de-energize their lines to prevent fires since 2012. These kinds of outages have become more widespread in 2019 after it was discovered that a transmission line caused the 2018 Camp Fire, which killed 84 people and destroyed 19,000 buildings. The settlement bankrupted PG&E, which is one of the largest utilities in the U.S. Today in California, every aspect of preemptive shutoffs are regulated, including weather thresholds, notifications, and how utilities serve vulnerable populations. And recently, we've seen those extreme fire conditions move north. Over Labor Day weekend, we saw a case study in how different utilities handle these situations. The Beachy Creek Fire in Oregon that you see on the right there originally started as three separate fires caused by lightning in August. But on September 7th, high winds and dry fuel caused explosive fire growth. And as the fire moved westward, there were 13 spot fires in Santiam Canyon, which is between the towns of Gates and Detroit that you see there. The cause is still under investigation, but downed power lines are suspected. And there are several utilities that run lines through that area. Consumer Power and Lane Electrical Co-op, both of those proactively shut off power. Portland General Electric, they have customers on the western edge of that fire front, and they implemented their first fire safety shutoff for this event. PacifiCorp and BPA kept their lines live. And the fallout still remains to be seen, but PacifiCorp now faces two lawsuits related to fire damage. Oregon legislature is considering a bill that would require all electric utilities to have preemptive shutoff procedures in place based on best practices. Next slide. So we spent the last few months studying these best practices, and we know that a fire safety outage is a heavy lift in communications and operations. And I'm going to use PGE as an example because They're the most well-known, and their outages are the most extensive. So in 2019, when it announced, they call it a public safety power shutoff, it affected more than 700,000 customers. That happened on a Monday when it notified the public that it might be shutting off power by Wednesday. There were so many people clamoring to know if they were in that affected area that the website crashed, their call center was overwhelmed, and by the time that power was actually shut off on Wednesday, there were still many people who didn't know what was going on. We know that they set up community resource centers where people could charge their phones and cool off, but it was not adequately staffed. They inspected lines by Friday, and the power was back on by Saturday. And it's of note that that same year, while that particular outage kind of stands out in people's minds, PG&E noted more than 140 incidents of damage to the equipment that would have led to ignitions if they hadn't de-energized the lines. So there were some lessons learned there. I'll also just speak briefly about San Diego G&E. They pioneered power shutoffs in 2007, but again, didn't become more widespread until 2019. And they were largely successful because those outages were very targeted. They have a staff of meteorologists and fire experts on staff, so they have a better idea of scope. And PG&E, which has learned from these lessons, they are committed to reducing the scope by at least a third fewer customers for 2021, and they plan to decrease the duration and the frequency of those outages. So some of the lessons learned, I'll just go through quickly through this bulleted list. We know that these kinds of outages are more successful when the area is limited through targeted forecasts and risk studies. We know that we need to continue making investments in fire hardening technology for our power lines. We know that we're going to have to staff up our call center and make sure that our website can handle the traffic. We know that we could invest more in outage communications like text messaging and outage maps and interactive voice response. And we're going to have to lean heavily on our partners, including nonprofits and any agency that has a trusted relationship with customers in the area that's impacted. And we also need to discuss mitigation. I mean, what we're seeing at other utilities, some utilities offer access to those community care centers. Some of them offer generators to certain customers and water. Some offer gasoline stations. They keep them open. And it's a real balance that's based on the needs of the community, and that remains to be discussed on what would work for our area. And for this next slide, I'll leave it to Chad Bowman to talk about some of these risk studies and what we're finding.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission and Compliance. Can you hear me today? Awesome. So up on the screen, as we're thinking about fire safety outage management and what are the highest fire risk areas in the county and places that our own infrastructure might cause a fire that severely impacts the community, and really thinking about how to ensure safety for the public, ensure long-term viability for our customer owners. Really, the Plain, Lake Wenatchee, Coles Corner jumps out. And there's a number of studies in that area. You might remember in 2017, the district did a wildfire study. We used a consultant, HDR. There were some areas up here that we're still working to address. The following year, the Forest Service actually did a study called the Pacific Northwest Quantitative Wildfire Risk Assessment, which a lot of people more commonly refer to as either the Rick Stratton study or the Pyrologic study, that again really identified in the Pacific Northwest that this is one of the highest fire danger areas in this region. Subsequently, the county has developed a community wildfire protection plan that by and large is based on a lot of the work done in that Forest Service study. DNR has done a lot of work in this area in the last year, looking at the wildfire risks and forest health to inform those DNR strategic plans. And we've actually, in the last 6 to 9 months, re-engaged with a California wildfire consultant. This is one of the maps from some of his work that also really zooms in on this area of the county as the highest wildfire risk. There's a lot of wildland urban interface in this area where homes are interspersed amongst the forest. And it's also the area of the county, high wildfire risk, a lot of wildland urban interface, and coupled with a significant concentration of overhead electrical facilities, both the transmission and distribution that could start a fire, which is why we're concentrating in this area for this year. Next slide. One of the things we asked our consultant to do was to make tier levels, risk tier levels, out of the overhead infrastructure tiers 1, 2, and 3, where the California equivalent would be a tier 3 needing a power system shutoff plan or a fire safety outage management. So we drew this boundary on the map. There's 3,900 meters in this area, and both overhead distribution and transmission is all tier 3. And what we realized looking at this map was if the transmission is tier 3, that really means that everything downstream of that, if you take the transmission out, also comes out, resulting in this, what we're calling at least a worst case outage for our phase 1 area this year. Before I pass that over to Chad Rissman, I'll ask if there's any questions. You're up, Chad.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Chad Rissman, Director of Distribution Asset Management Engineering. So I want to talk a little bit about the plan itself. Chad and Rachel talked a little bit about the things leading up to this. So the actual deliverable that we're moving in the direction of, looking for your support on, is a fire outage management plan. And so really this is to a plan where we'd be documenting, building all of our situational awareness type things, how we respond, decision making to manage the fire safety outage event itself. So in that plan, we'll be stating our purpose to protect people and property by decreasing the risk of wildland fire ignitions from utility infrastructure. So that's the area that we're focused in on, is in the event mitigating the event that a power line could ignite a fire. In the plan, we want to focus in on really key elements of this, is when are we going to trigger that power safety outage? So in this plan, we're going to be developing, and as Chad was discussing with fire experts and also working with our local experts, we're going to put together, looks like, two key triggers. One is going to be wind, and the other one is going to be dry fuel load. And I believe that is the fire index. Not being a fire expert, I'm glad that we're going to be working with a lot of fire experts. So this is a policy, a procedure, would be a policy and procedure that we would use as a last resort. What does that mean? Well, it means in extreme fire weather conditions. So the two things that, the combination of things that we'd be monitoring would be higher winds or high winds, and work has begun and ongoing on what actual trigger that wind miles per hour, for example, would be at what elevation. So work is ongoing on that. And then the next one is going to be the burn index. So how dry is it? Somewhat correlative to red flag warning days. The triggers might be a little bit different, but a similar scenario. On the right-hand side there, we borrowed a illustration from another utility that we're hoping to and working towards putting together sort of a dashboard that I would expect that we would expect that we would be able to publish. So not only us internally be monitoring these two triggers, but something that we could also share with the public. In this example, this is just an illustration of what we're hoping to be putting forward. The blue lines showing sort of what the wind is doing throughout a period of time, and the various thresholds were set up. One might be a warning, one might be a get ready, and the 100% threshold potentially could be, all right, we've hit the threshold, now we're going to implement the power safety shutoff. And then once conditions fall down below those, that would trigger an event to start the restoration. As Chad talked about, we're focusing in on the most vulnerable areas for the reasons that he stated. And this plan's gonna become a living document. We are phasing this in, looking at the area that we're really focused in on, the Plain and Lake Wenatchee area. But we expect to be able to mature and grow this plan and maybe even expand this into other areas. Even though we're focused in on the Plain and Lake Wenatchee area, we also understand there's fire risk throughout the county. So this becomes a living document, and we want to make sure that we're incorporating lessons learned and things into that document. Next slide, please. So four primary components. There's a lot of words on this page, but hopefully I can summarize those. The four components of the plan that we're working on and are recommending to put together is going to include a preparation portion, a mitigate portion, a respond portion, and a recover portion. So this would be the plan to manage the power safety shutoff. In the preparation phase, we're going to be talking about some of the things that we had mentioned is what's our situational awareness, what are our triggers, who are we coordinating with, what are the impacts that we're going to have, communication, cell phones, emergency responders, trying to understand and prepare with those groups, which is the first part of what we're recommending moving forward is coordinating with our experts, our local experts. The next one is mitigate. Rachel mentioned a little bit about the vulnerable population, the impact of this power outage, what are some of the things that we can put together and prepare for, and then mitigate once we put it in place. Respond, the next section, implementing an incident command structure here at the district that we learned a lot from fire and storm events. We've got an incident command team that we would stand up that would be managing the power safety shutoff. We would monitor the situation, we would organize our response, organize our crews, and then also be preparing for restorations when the conditions were realized. And then the recovery, so after the event, after action report, incident report, debriefing with our responders, our collaborators, with our customers, and going back and improving our plan. I think the next slide, Rachel's going to take over.
Yeah. So I just want to emphasize here that we are still really early in developing this plan. And this is just what we've studied in best practices is what this might look like at Chelan County. So we just wanted to give you an idea of what this might look like just based on our preliminary research. 5 to 7 days ahead is what we've heard you can start seeing that fire weather start to develop. And so we would stand up our internal incident command system. We would continue to monitor the weather because it could change. And then we'd notify our emergency response partners about those conditions developing. So we're talking about fire districts and the sheriff's office, and we have a whole list of emergency response partners. 3 to 4 days ahead, we're in the watch zone. We're going to be briefing our emergency response partners. We're going to be starting to prepare our messaging and staffing up the call center. I hear some music.
Yeah, hang on for 1 second. We'll see if we can mute that.
Thank you. Appreciated that. Okay, so continuing on, day two is really the day we go public. So if we continue to see this extreme fire weather developing, we would contact our Medline customers, we would call our key accounts, we would notify customers with as many tools as we have available, and then we'd have a media advisory, a press conference if necessary. That's when we really want everyone to know. In fire safety, in the outage itself, the day of, we would continue notifications. And again, another media advisory, another briefing with our emergency response partners, letting our customers know. And then we shut off power. Once the weather events have subsided, we're going to send out crews to inspect our lines to see if there are any new fire starts. And I want to be clear that this inspection piece of it is the majority, it usually is the majority of the outage time. That even after the weather has passed, the inspection can take longer than the weather itself. So we'll, again, send out notifications. We'll be briefing our emergency response partners. We'll let the media know when we've started those inspections. And hopefully we'll have an estimated time when power will come back on. Once power is restored, again, another round of notifications, another round of a media advisory, and then we'll debrief with our emergency response partners and the impacted community to make sure that we're improving this plan as we go. Next slide. So project timeline, we are still in phase one in the green. We have, we've identified the communities most at risk. We've reviewed our emergency outage plan. We've researched our best practices. We have the beginnings of a draft plan and communications materials, and we would like the head nod from you to go to phase two, which is where we further develop this with our emergency response partners and telecom agencies. And then we'll go back to the board in April to tell you what we found. And then we'll move on to phase three, which is that orange stage, where we'll do outreach sessions with the community, and we know that with COVID, that's probably going to look virtual. So we have Generom setting up an open house, a virtual open house, and we'll have town hall meetings, likely virtual. And then in June, we'll come back to the board and report what we found. And if the plan is approved, we'll start conducting tabletop exercises so that we can practice and ensure that we are prepared if necessary for the 2021 fire season. Next page. So Chad Rissman's going to talk more about what that next phase is going to look like.
Thank you, Rachel. Right, so coordinating with our emergency response agencies and partners, we want to bring the beginning of our plan to the group of our local fire experts and emergency responders, get some feedback from them, collaborate with them, provide them the information that we've identified and that we've found, share with them lessons learned from other utilities, and try to work on this plan so that it's consistent with Chelan PUD and also consistent with Chelan County. So with your guidance, that would be the next part. The next phase of this, we've identified several of our key partners and who that group would be. We're probably going to manage that with an incident command team, at least that's the current idea. So we would coordinate with those public and expert partners. I think that was anything to add there, Rachel?
No, I think we're ready for discussion at this point. Board members, do you have any questions for us?
Commissioners?
Yeah, I do. It's probably for Chad. And in the past, you know, have we been in a situation where we have cut the power in one of these type of situations? And if so, you know, was our decision making any different than what we're proposing here?
It is different. Thank you, Commissioner Bolt. What we are talking about doing is preemptively turning off the power before a fire starts. So our current practice right now is to coordinate once there is a fire established and an incident team, whether it's local or regional incident team, is managing that. We really work very closely with the fire managers to understand and request that they request power to be shut off, really trying to keep power on as long as we can during those events. This would be something different. That's more responding to a fire and concerned about firefighting personnel and the safety of the personnel with overhead power lines. This would be something that we would do to turn the power off before a fire even got started. But I just wanted to mention, Rachel mentioned about restoration practices. One of the things that takes quite a bit of time here is that once we would turn the power off, all of the power lines need to be inspected. Since the trigger for this is going to be a fairly high wind, we would expect that there would be vegetation primarily, but potentially other damage that once energized could ignite a fire. So we want to make sure that if we took the power system out of service, that when we went back into service, we wouldn't start a fire then. So lots of time to make sure we get eyes on all equipment and all parts and pieces before they are restored. Does that answer your question, Commissioner Bolt?
It does. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions, commissioners? So, Rachel, could you rephrase what you're looking for? You want a head nod as to moving on to that next phase of engagement out in the community.
We're looking for a head nod to engage our emergency response partners first. We're going out to the community later. So first we talk to our emergency response partners and further develop the plan. And we'd like your blessing before we do that.
Commissioners?
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
And this has to do with emergency response partners. And I'm thinking from the standpoint of an incident command, are we thinking that our fellow PUDs, Douglas and Grant, would be part of an incident command for this, therefore be part of the emergency response partners you're discussing?
Commissioner, I would say I think our focus is Chelan County right now. And so at this point, when you look at the highest fire risk, both statewide and in the county, it's up in the Upper Valley. So it tends not to connect to Douglas and Grant at this point.
So I saw two thumbs up. Gary, are you comfortable? Okay. So Rachel, it looks like you have a thumbs up to move forward with that work. And thank you for the presentation today. It was informative and very thought-provoking.
Thank you, commissioners. We'll be back with you shortly.
Okay. Excuse me. So we are now ready to move on into the consent agenda. The consent agenda now includes items number 11 and 12, the regular agenda. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as amended to include items 11 and 12.
And I'll second that. Gary seconds. Do we have any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying yes with a thumbs up. Okay, opposed? It's passed. So, Steve, we are on to the regular agenda with item number 10.
Yes, this is a resolution ratifying field worker change orders number 1 and 2 and authorizing the general manager to execute field worker change order number 3 on the design build services contract for the Rock Island Dam Powerhouse number 2 generating unit rehabilitation contract with GE Renewable US LLC of Greenwood Village, Colorado. John Sagerster will be presenting.
Good afternoon, commissioners. You guys hear me okay? Excellent. Again, John Sagerser, project manager or program manager, rather, for Powerhouse 2 Rehabilitation. As Steve mentioned, this is a resolution to ratify the first two field work orders associated with pre-construction services with GE for our design-build contract and requesting authorization to execute a third. So field work order 1 added hourly rates for the year 2020. And field work order 2 extended the completion date for pre-construction services from December 15th to March 5th. There was no contract price changes associated with either of these first two field work orders. Field work order 3, the one we're requesting permission to authorize or to execute, will further extend the completion date of pre-construction services from March 5th to May 31st. It will also add $1 million to pre-construction services, increasing the not to exceed amount from $4.5 million to $5.5 million. The additional cost and associated time and work was planned to be completed as part of one of the first guaranteed maximum price amendments to be executed with GE. However, execution of the GMPs is being delayed while we negotiate the extended warranty. So the extended warranty is a critical piece to the district and something we want to, is very important to us, want to make sure that we want to get it right. So this is a little bit different. Normally we would execute a GMP rather than extending of pre-construction services, but we'd like to do this in order to focus on that extended warranty negotiation. So again, this is just moving money and work forward in time or into pre-construction services. We're not adding any new work, nothing that we hadn't anticipated doing or money that we hadn't anticipated spending. We're just moving it from one phase of the project into an earlier phase of the project. One of the most important things that this will do for us is it will allow GE to continue to keep their engineers assigned to the project and actively engaged in the design process while we negotiate the extended warranty. Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? So at this point, I'd like to have a motion for resolution or item number 10.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolution number 10 as presented.
There a second? Second.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, signify.
Commissioners, Eric, say.
Recording.
Yeah, would you mind? I hate to be a bugger, but indicating.
Oh, that's right, we're recording. So,
right.
All those in favor, would you signify by saying aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, commissioners.
Okay. Steve, I'm going to turn this over to you now.
Okay, we have a few manager's items. And by the way, commissioners, just so you know, we do not have an executive session item today. So we will be finished when we get through the regular agenda here. I want to start with Sean Seaman and Tracy Hunt with a legislative update.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Tracy, are you online and want to make any statements before I start?
No, go right ahead, Sean.
Right. So is the presentation up? I'm sorry.
It is.
Okay, thank you very much. So next slide, please. So again, where we are, middle of the session, just an update of where we are, some interest bills of interest. I will not go through all of them that I've listed. I will highlight some, but I will ask if the commissioners have any questions on the bills I do not dig into. Please let me know if you have any questions. So we'll go over what we think is going to happen the rest of the session as well. Next slide, please. So we are at week 8. We are over halfway, I'm happy to say. There were 1,012 bills last time I checked in the end of February, and the numbers slowed down greatly. We don't anticipate any new bills coming forward just because the timing is such that it's, it would be very hard, but not impossible, to get new bills introduced and through the process, especially if they're about budgets they could get through. The first policy and fiscal committee cutoff dates have passed. The next one coming up is March 9th, and that's when the bills have to be out of the House of Origin. As I passed over, budget bill hearings have not started yet, but we anticipate those starting up here within the next couple weeks. One other thing I threw in here is that the Utilities and Transportation Commission, UTC, they extended the disconnection moratorium for IOUs to July 31st. Now, as you recall, the disconnection moratorium for utilities, and I had reported this wrong the last time, but I corrected via an email, that the consumer-owned utility cutoff dates were just extended till April 30th, which is after the session, and we do not know at this point, but we can. It's probably safe to expect that the our moratorium for our customers will probably be extended by the governor, but that is not a given at this point. Next slide, please. So as we've talked before, our top legislative priorities are still Dryden, the wastewater funding. We have a capital fund budget request, and that is going to be through the local community project. We have about $1 million request on that through that program. And the grant request, which is through the Department of Ecology, mainly through the Centennial Clean Water grant program, that's about around $2.5 million. The Clean Energy Fund is something that's operated through Commerce, and we have a project we'd like to see funded potentially through the research development of funding mechanism. So we're working to make sure the language that's within the capital budget is broad enough to allow the type of projects we want to seek funding for. The last two are the wildfire legislation. 1168 is the legislation being promoted by Commissioner Hillary Franz of the Department of Natural Resources. This would do various things, including, as I've noted here, forest restoration, community resilience, wildfire response, and it's on the floor right now. And this bill, it also has other fundings for things such as aerial assets as well. So that is still awaiting floor action, but it has time. It would be it's likely not subject to cutoff because it'll be necessary to implement the budget. 5158, this is Senator Hawkins' bill, and it has made it through. I said it was on the floor, but actually was approved by the Senate over the weekend or last Friday at this point. Next slide, please. So I just want to say congratulations, pass on to Senator Hawkins, has worked that bill very hard, and he's gotten strong support from the PUDs as well. On to energy carbon pricing. The 5126 is a cap and invest bill. It has passed out of committee on February 25th. It's now in the Ways and Means Committee. And it is definitely necessary to implement the budget, so it could be around for a long time. But the second bill I noted on there, 5373, was a carbon fee bill. It was just interesting dynamics that Senator Carlisle wanted to make sure his bill, 5126, was passed out of committee before he heard the carbon fee bill, which would be in conflict with his cap and invest bill. And the hearing is set for March 4th, this Thursday. The low carbon fuel standard bill, 1091, It's on the floor. It actually was. It's interesting when I do these reports. This was on the floor when I made this, wrote this up, but it's passed the House and is on its way to the Senate now. I'm going to jump down to, if I can get to the next slide, unless there's any question on the bills on there I haven't spoken of. Okay, next slide, please. For the PUDs, I think you're probably pretty aware of the House Bill 1336. This would grant retail authorities for PUDs. It has made it through the House and is into the Senate, and it's just waiting to be scheduled for a hearing in the Senate Energy and Technology Committee. 5383 was a bill sponsored by Senator Wellman, and it is also a retail authority bill, but it's very restrictive in that it only allows retail authority in unserved areas of the state. And it is actually, again, it has passed the Senate as of this weekend. Now is on its way to the House. 5357, which is an interesting bill. It actually sets up an account within the state broadband office to offer grants to accelerate broadband deployment in the state. It's similar to the 1168, the welfare bill. It creates an account, but doesn't create any funding for that. So at least by having an account and the way that account would be used, it would pass. Then it's just a matter of getting funding into the state broadband office to provide grants. Again, if we can move on to the next slide, please. The human resource safety bills, we've been watching these, it seems like from day one of the session, but 1093 was an extension of the paid family medical leave. It extended the eligibility by changing the definition of family member and also amount of time you needed to work to qualify under this program. 1073, the definition of family member was dropped, and it strictly has a provision that allows eligibility into the program based on lesser time worked. I did not put on here, but I should have added Bill 5097, which is a Senate version of the bill, not a companion bill, but it does the same thing. And it does have the problematic family member language, but that bill is being worked hard by a coalition of business and other entities that are concerned about expansion of the paid family medical leave bill. So that other bill, 5097, it's awaiting floor action in the Senate right now. The other one I'll note on here is 5115. And this is an expansion of, and I would also say potentially 1097. These were both trying to do more for health of workers in the state. And these are related to COVID-19. And we saw that a number of different bills in the session this year that have done just that, that have been in response to COVID. And 1076 and 1097 seem to be doing that. But these have become permanent rules. They're not limited to just COVID response. Next bill, next page, please. Water, I'm happy to say water issues have been pretty minimal. This water rights banking project is mainly for it converts bank water rights into a trust water right, and it's a pilot project in the Walla Walla area. Just added that into here because it could be a precedent if that pilot project works out well to be able to move water rights from a banking project into a trust right. Next slide, please. So the other bills of interest we've been tracking, I'll touch on many of these, is Senate Bill 1446 was a bill that was in response to, again, COVID, and then some utilities concerned about not being able to meet their conservation goals under the Energy Independence Act, and they were seeking some relief. There was a bill also by Waputa that didn't make it forward. This bill is much more narrow in its scope, and it seems to be getting some support, and it has made it into rules and is waiting floor action. We talked briefly there was a little conversation earlier today about the public meetings bills. In both these bills, 1056, it's more of an emergency response bill. Would require public meetings held remotely, or you could have different requirements for remote meetings when there's an emergency declared. So 1056 is related to emergencies and some provisions about remote meetings. That bill has now made it into the Senate. But 1329 another Open Public Meetings Act bill really has changed quite a bit to, instead of making some requirements, it encourages public comments in meetings. It encourages audio and video recording, but it also adds a requirement to announce, adding the announcements of reasons. Now, bear with me for a second. The announcement of reasons for executive sessions must be in the minutes. So if you have an announcement around an executive session and the reason, it now will have to be in the minutes and just being part of the recording. It would have to show up in the permit minutes. The 1117 is a bill that has changed quite a bit as well, but this one requires some amendments and changes to Growth Management Act comprehensive plans to address net ecological gain, but for public projects only. Language has changed. Instead of saying that public projects would have to achieve net ecological gain, it says now these public projects would have to contribute towards that, but there's still some concerns with the scope of this bill and what it would mean to public projects, such as many that we do at the PUD. I won't touch on 1099, but I will say it's 1368. This bill has actually been passed, and this was the funding from the federal government. It was about a $1.5 billion bill. The governor has signed this, but $325 million of that bill was earmarked for rental and utility assistance for customers across the state. And finally, I'm not going to dig deeply into 5141. HEAL is Healthy Environment for All Act. It's in the rules, and this is a very wide and broad bill that would require various actions of state governments when they're considering significant actions. It had to consider some environmental justice principles within these significant actions, and also add environmental principles into their strategic plans. This bill creates an environmental justice council and requires environmental justice assessments for significant actions by state agencies. And it's just a subset of state agencies that are impacted by this, not all state agencies. But for instance, it does impact Department of Health, Department of Ecology, and Department of Natural Resources. We do not know what the implications of this will mean yet. In some conversations, it's not really clear to agencies what this will mean yet. So we're all trying to sort this through. But what I think is interesting about this particular bill, this environmental justice bill, is that it has a nexus to the carbon cap and invest bill, which also creates a similar environmental justice and equity panel. And the two committees, is the council that's created in the HEAL Act, would need to collaborate with the panel that's created in the Cap and Invest Act to make sure that they remain aligned with what they're trying to do in the state in relationship to environmental justice. And one of the things I noted, and I think it's interesting this year, that there's quite a few bills that are doing just that, addressing environmental justice or things related to workers and poverty and vulnerable populations. And we're seeing that, including the wildfire funding bill, addresses and recognizes the need to think about vulnerable populations. So we're seeing this theme, if you will, sort of weave its way through different legislation this year. This theme of considering highly impacted communities, environmental justice, and vulnerable populations. We've seen it before, but I think for me, it's the first time we've seen it woven in amongst the legislation to the extent we have this year. I believe that's my last slide, correct? The next one's questions. So I open it up to questions, commissioners.
Thanks, Sean, for the update. Commissioners, do we have any questions for Sean? Implications of bills?
Very good.
Great. Thank you, Sean, for your update.
You're welcome.
Next up, commissioners, want to invite Tracy Young to give you an update on what's going on at Town Toyota Center.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Tracy Young, External Affairs. I wanted to cover a couple of things. First is a parks use request. The town side, as you know, has ramped up from, I think they started about 100 vaccinations initially to 400 to 600. Now they're at about 1,000. and they will be moving potentially to 2,000 and maybe more. So what they're finding is that they have some staging issues with the cars. So on your screen, you'll see an aerial view of the park area. Town Toyota Center is in the top left, and then our park over on the right. And what they're talking about is creating basically a long line where they can stage cars away from traffic out in Walla Walla Avenue, and use that area to keep their workers out from danger, basically, and be able to do the check-in process. So the idea would be to bring the cars in, actually stage them all the way around the little circle area, down in that long parking area, probably even have two lines of cars, and then up towards the corner right there, there would be another check-in, and use that parking area, basically, yeah, that whole area right there with three or four lines of cars staged. And then once there's availability over in the other parking area, they would free up a group of cars in that area, and then take them over into the town center for the vaccination. This did happen last week. There was a situation where the vaccine process started a little late, and they had a lot of people showing up early, and it became apparent that they needed to have some flex capacity. So they've asked for us to look into that. Ryan Baker has looked into coordinating impacts to the shelter on the bottom of the screen there, down by the Google Earth sign, and then also looking at what it would take to make sure we still have access for the ball fields and tennis courts and things like that. So that's a request in place that we're expecting to work through this week, and we would need to communicate that with our park users. Before I go on to the PUD support, are there any questions? Okay. So the next part I wanted to provide an update on was the PUD support. To date, we've been providing snow removal, security, traffic control, radios, portable power generation, fueling. And the Chelan Douglas Health District and the Incident Command have asked us to consider providing ongoing support going forward. It's been a great partnership, helping to make sure that the vaccine site ran smoothly or runs smoothly. And so they've offered to pursue two things. One is cost recovery for the services that we've provided to date. So we've provided them a rundown. We've kept track of everything that we've spent, and they're working to with FEMA on a cost recovery package. In addition to that, they are very interested to have us continue essentially the same services going forward, where they would provide a cost recovery on a monthly basis. One of the things that I think we're good at is surge capacity, kind of acting like a shock absorber, helping them as something comes up, and they see a lot of value in having us as a partner, especially with the park across the street, the generator, and the ability to come in and help in certain situations. So going forward, we would provide many of the same services while also being able to respond to support in the event our resources align with their needs. So we expect to work through the details of that in the coming days. Any questions on that, or concerns or thoughts?
Great, thank you, Tracy, for that update.
Okay, commissioners, it's a little out of order, but I understand Chelan Mayor Getty is on the line, and he had wanted to offer public comment. If it's all right with you, I'd suggest that we go to that now.
Okay, certainly. This is Perry, the city clerk. Let me get him on the line. I've been monitoring the meeting for his turn. Can you just give me like 1 minute?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you so much.
Actually, while we're waiting, I think maybe John has a very quick update on an avalanche situation. Maybe we could take that. And John, are you ready?
Yeah, I certainly can. Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director, Customer Utilities. Although we've seen a lot of our snow disappear down here in the valley floor, it's a different story up in the pass. And the snow activity brings some avalanches. Couple things that transpired on Friday. We got notice from Puget Sound Energy that their transmission line that runs up and we meet at the top of the pass was hit by an avalanche, took out one of their structures and buried the line, I believe, around 30 feet of snow. So that's important for us. You know, that's a conduit of power, but it also is a back feed for us if we have any concerns or any issues that happen on our line. The transmission line running up the east side of the pass. So from what I understand, they were doing avalanche control today. They have crews ready to go in and restore that line. It'll probably take several days, and hopefully by the end of the week, that line is fully functional. So it just puts us at a little bit of a risk factor of not having a redundancy on our side. And then secondly, on Saturday morning very early, we were hit in part of our distribution system on the other side of the pass, down around the burn substation, took out around 20 poles were impacted by some avalanche activity. So a pretty dangerous situation. Crews did what they could to work around and get a couple of the areas back in service. But one area that will be out for a while is the DOT shed that's up there. I've been working with them. They understand the situation, but it's just something that, again, with the avalanche activity, we want to be very careful on how we proceed in restoring that as well. So just wanted to make you aware of those situations and let me know if you have any questions.
Any questions, commissioners?
Just one. I'd like to just make a comment. And John, just I know you guys are telling crews to be careful and taking ultimate precaution, but by golly, be safe. You know, the avalanche danger right now is very high. So worry about everybody up there concerned that's trying to work in that environment.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, safety is definitely a paramount when working in this environment.
Okay. Do we have Bob online with us?
Yeah, Bob is still on his way here, but this is Wade Ferris, City Administrator, and I've got my Public Works Director here as well. I know you guys are trying to get stuff done. So if you want us to proceed, we will. Or if you want us to break in when Bob gets here, we can do that too.
Are you ready to start? Did you want to present something or do you want to wait until Bob gets there?
No, we can go ahead because Jake's the one, our Public Works Director. And I know we were trying to, you know, to get to you guys and I know we weren't part of the agenda, but we think this is an important issue. So okay. I'll let Jake describe that, please.
Please go ahead.
Very good. Well, first of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to attend your meeting today. I'd like to preface that we're really not looking for any answers. We wanted to introduce a project that the city's working on that we feel like the success of it will hinge on developing a good partnership with the PUD. So I believe some exhibits have been distributed, and I thought maybe it'd just be appropriate to kind of give a 10,000-foot snapshot of this project. So if you look at Exhibit A, just an overview, you're looking at kind of the downtown, the main 100 and 200 block of downtown Chelan between Wooden and Johnson Avenue. And we're looking at replacing the infrastructure in the alleyway there. It's going to be a water main replacement, a sewer main replacement, and a stormwater infrastructure installation. And one of the things we did, we're in the design phase of this project right now. We're at approximately 60%, and we appreciate our relationship we have with the PUD, and one of the first things we've done is we've reached out to your staff and start a dialogue on seeing what may be able to get done to underground power utilities. So the PUD has, I believe, power and fiber dry utilities in this alleyway. And so on Exhibit B, you can kind of get a little bit of a glimpse of what that looks like right now in at least one part of the alley. And then on the following exhibit, Exhibit C, you can kind of get a snapshot of what our vision, the city's vision, looks like with these utilities being undergrounded. And so we've gone down, done some preliminary work with our consulting engineers to develop a underground electrical utility layout that was kind of done in cooperation with the PUD staff. And I guess our point today is we don't want to understate how important this project is to the city. It's a project that's been identified in our comprehensive planning. It's got a lot of support in the community from business owners, downtown association, and we just see you know, the type of infrastructure we're replacing, we're looking at 50-year service lives for them. And so we just really, to the maximum extent we can, we want to do a comprehensive utility improvement and get it all done in one foul swoop. And so that's kind of our introduction, at least. We are at a point now where we would like to get some information that would allow our mayor and council to make decisions on moving this forward from a cost standpoint, and develop those so we can make some decisions. Our mayor just popped in. Maybe I'll give him an opportunity to say hello.
Well, how's the commissioners doing today? Beautiful day out there. One of the reasons we chose to make another contact for y'all is it would be difficult to rip this street up after 50 years and then have to go back through it and do it again at the time that you could be able to put in the underground wiring. So if we could work in conjunction with this thing, it would be a one-shot deal and good for both of us. And if you can't do the whole project, would it be engineering possible to at least put the conduit in the ground so we don't have to rip the asphalt up?
So, and we do understand to some level that after talking with staff and having site visits in September last year, that there are potentially some issues with spacing and odd voltages and aging infrastructure that the PUD has in that alley. And we just look for any way possible that you may be able to partner with us. And obviously, we understand your policies on underground and utilities, and we understand the provisions set forth in the franchise agreement that we have with the PUD. And work within those, but to find a way to work together to see if we can't comprehensively improve and replace the utilities in this part of our town that's real important, we feel like. So anyways, that's really all we have. Just wanted to introduce it.
Great. I appreciate that. And commissioners, any questions? All right. Well,
commissioners, Commissioner McKenna, if I could just offer one quick comment. So, you know, we've been aware for a number of years that there was an interest in possibly pursuing this, and we really appreciate the way the city is coming forward with this and working within our existing policies. The challenge that we're going to have is last year was our largest year for capital investment since Rocky Reach Dam was built, and this year we're going to try to do more than that. So, well, we didn't really have this in our work plan. On the other hand, we know it's important to the city. And so we are trying to figure out how we're going to be able to address this. And I heard a couple of different ways it could be approached. So we want to work with you to try to figure out what it is that we can do that will get the city what it absolutely needs, and yet at the same time be able to continue with the existing workload, the projects that we have going on, some of which actually support Chelan as well. So that's our challenge, is just trying to figure out how we fit this in with the other work that we've got going on. But appreciate that it's important, and we want to find a way to be able to work together.
I want to thank you for the time to at least present this. Appreciate that.
Steve, this is Ann.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Go ahead, Ann.
Yeah. Thanks. I just wanted to thank Bob and the others for coming in. Open communication, collaborating is so important. I really agree that now's the time to look at this, to consider at least putting in the conduit. So, yeah, and I'm happy to hear Steve Wright come on and explain our challenges so that, you know, we're all above board and communicating well on this. Let's keep it going and keep working together.
Concur with Ann. Thank you.
Well, the mayor, Shalane, why don't you come up here and spend some money? We're open and waiting for you.
We're all hoping to get out of jail pretty soon, Bob. And be able to do those things.
Gentlemen, thank you for visiting with us today.
You're most welcome.
Thank you for having us. Steve, I'll turn this back over to you.
Okay, just got a couple of more manager's items. First, want to ask Rachel Hansen to get an update on some media that will be taking place around the juvenile fish bypass system this week.
Hello, commissioners. This is Rachel Hansen again. Hey, I just wanted to give you guys a heads up that I am meeting Don Seabrook, who's a photographer with the Wenatchee World at Rock Island tomorrow. He's going to be taking photos of our dive team as they place the equipment that we need to complete our 10-year fish study. So this is the equipment that will detect salmon as they move through the dam. So that's going to be happening tomorrow morning, and you might see that in the paper in the coming days. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Okay, I want to finish with, I've gotten a couple of inquiries, and I think board members have gotten some inquiries from the public about what happened in Texas, the difficulties that occurred there on the electric power system, and whether that relates to Washington State, Chelan County, and specifically. I'm going to give you a quick overview of this, and then I expect we'll come back with something more elaborate at a later date. Couple of thoughts. First of all, what happened in Texas is a combination of bad luck and bad policy. It's bad luck in terms of a 1-in-100-year storm. Yes, they've had cold weather before, but nothing, at least as far as I'm aware in recorded history, that was as bad as what happened a week ago. Could that happen here? Yes. I mean, we could always have worse weather than has occurred historically, and we plan for the worst weather historically. So that is always a challenge to think about. When you think about that, there's always a trade-off between cost and reliability. So you can have really great reliability, but it is expensive to do that. So there's always that trade-off between the two. Having said that, I would expect we're going to at least revisit our policies with respect to how to handle bad weather and just think through what the implications might be for us. Bad policy. So there are certain things in Texas about the market and the way it was organized, especially as a deregulated market with elements that allowed retail access and retail customers to be served at spot market prices. Generally a terrible idea. I think across the utility industry, it was recognized as not a very good idea. They went ahead with it anyway, and now they've got folks with thousands of dollars worth of bills just for a week's worth of electricity. The other part that was pretty significant about Texas is that they relied on the market in a way that we do not in the Northwest, and so I would say that risk is minimized here. One thing in which there is a corollary to what's going on here right now and is a concern, although what was going on in Texas was significantly worse than where we stand in the Northwest, and that is they're planning reserve margin, the amount of reserve capacity that they required to be online was below 8%. I would say in the utility industry, if it gets below 15%, most people would say that's getting kind of low. And, you know, clearly this was well below that. But could it happen here? This is the issue that we've talked about here with this board a number of times over the last couple of years, that as we retire our baseload coal plants in the Northwest, loss of load probability, which we use, by the way, reserve margin is sort of a standard metric in the utility industry. Loss of load probability is a more sophisticated way of doing the analysis that we use in the Northwest. Our loss of load probability is about at the bare minimum, And without some significant additions to generating resources or demand-side measures in the next couple of years, we'll go to what would be considered extraordinarily high levels. So we have certainly a big concern as to whether the system here is being built in a way that would be resource adequate. And I think you're aware there's a big effort amongst the utilities in the region to try to put in place a resource adequacy standard. And certainly the events in Texas have added fuel to the fire for the need for a resource adequacy standard. So that's a quick overview. I'll just take any questions, and again, we'll get back to you with more at a later date.
I don't know about my fellow commissioners, but this has been interesting as people have approached me and talked to me about this. But I keep thinking that I need to keep learning about the whole issue of resource adequacy. Lots of questions about electric vehicles in the future, and it just seems to continually come at me. So I think anything that we can do as commissioners to continue to learn about resource adequacy and how we deal with our planning efforts would be most helpful in the future.
Okay, we plan to add that to our list of things to come back in a study session item about.
Steve, if I can just ask a question, and it has to do with the resource mix that was in Texas compared to the resource mix that is in Washington. Did that have anything to do with it as well? Where they were getting their power, the type of production facility that was generating power, did that play a role?
Yes, in that about 60% of their supply in Texas is from natural gas. All of the resources, though, that were serving Texas, their planned output under stress conditions did not meet the test of what they assumed would be available. Generally, because of the cold weather, different impacts on different types of resources, but in all cases, it led to a decline in their output. Having said that, I will tell you that event of having a gas compressor, for example, not function in cold weather is not something that has never happened in the Northwest. It happened during a time when I was at Bonneville, and I remember it very clearly because it did create a resource inadequacy problem for a couple of days that was pretty scary. So I think that there's a tendency to want to say in these kinds of circumstances, well, that's totally different. And there is a lot that's very different about Texas, but there are some things that are similar too. And as a result, I think there are some things that we need to pay attention to in the Northwest.
Thanks, Steve. Steve, do you have anything else on your list?
That's it.
Okay. Commission items. Commissioners, is there anything to bring forward? All right. Lisa, are you available?
I am. I have the commissioner travel update, and there are no updates, but I'm happy to answer any questions or make any changes that any of you need for any upcoming events.
Lisa, go ahead, Ian.
Oh, okay, thanks. I do have an update. We had been really hopeful that our NWPPA, Northwest Public Power Association annual meeting, which is held in May every year, we were hopeful that we would be able to hold that meeting in person, but
the decision's been made now that it will be virtual. So I think we talked about maybe attending that this year. It was going to be in Washington State, probably in Tri-Cities. So that will not be, not be held other than, you know, in person. That will be a virtual meeting. September meeting, some of what's done at that annual meeting will be done at the September meeting, and hopefully that will be held in person so we can all see each other again. Can't wait.
Okay. Thank you.
And do you know where that September meeting is scheduled to take place?
You know, it may be Kennewick. We move around. There are eight states and a province, and we move around every year to different locations. And Kennewick, Tri-Cities was on the docket. I'll find out for you, Gary. Yeah, I'll let you know. Everybody know.
Thanks, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. I don't know if my fellow commissioners had the same reaction filling out timesheets this month, but that was 1 year ago that we started our different process for timesheets, and it's very interesting.
Yes, we make it work one way or another.
Well, thanks for your help doing that, Lisa, with us. So, okay, anything else for Lisa?
No, just on that matter, just being archaic, I just sent in my second one. I'm a little slower than the rest. I like doing it that way.
It's all processed. You're ready to go.
Yep. And by the way, McKenna, I copied your process.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. All right. Monkey see, monkey do. Yeah.
Here we go. Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
Commissioners, can I just raise one quick thing? So I don't know if you noticed this, but APPA has decided to do a combination live event and hybrid event for their national convention. The live event will be in June in Florida. The hybrid virtual event will be in July. So they're actually going to separate them in time. Something to be thinking about is just your willingness to travel. We also are still thinking through where we are with respect to a policy on business travel. We haven't shifted our policy yet. We said our policy would be good through the end of March. And we have not, while we are planning to begin to make a transition towards having people come back to work in those months of April through June, we haven't really settled on and haven't had much conversation as a senior team about business travel. So it's something just to put on the screen. I don't know you need to make any decisions today, but just be aware that that choice is going to be out there for you.
Yeah, all those choices are coming up for everybody, you know, as we move with kids coming back into school and people going back to work without immunizations. It's, you know, my opinion is try not to be any faster than you have to be, so. All right. Follow up on delegation of action items from our previous board meeting.
Yes, we actually had quite a few. On the visit from the Chelan County Housing Trust, we are looking into a connection between our conservation programs and those organizations. And you heard from Eric today with respect to the legal authority about discounted or waived hookup fees. I've got an assignment that's going to take some time to do, to look into, we'll call it a primer on hydrogen. We had been doing some work in that area already, but it still needs a fair amount of work. So it'll probably be, I would guess a couple of months before we will get back to you on that one. We are still working on the, $400,000 option for the PPP funds for Discovery Center. We had wanted to get you some more information. We have been doing some work on that. I hope it will be finished sometime this week, and we'll get to you. The 2019 comparison to 2020 end-of-year performance plan results, Rebecca got that to me, and then I didn't get it to you, so I need to go get that and get it to you. So we'll hopefully get that done in the next couple of days. And you had asked for a follow-up on why did the cold temperatures affect the wind turbine functionality, and we did get more information, and Tracy Yunt's description at the last meeting was right on. It was really an icing problem on the blades that created the difficulties there. Any questions about any of that?
No.
Okay, would you like me to move on to delegated action items from this meeting?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Catherine Willard will provide information on items that impact fish return survival. Aline will also provide information on the maximum beneficial elevation gain for fish ladders. I'm going to get some information on the cost of reducing connection fees for purchasers of low-income housing, so we can take that next step as to what's the range of cost if we were to waive fees for waive hookup fees for low-income housing. We've got some follow-up in the low-income energy efficiency program, particularly with respect to what are customers getting, how much of a bill reduction are they getting for the investment that's being made. I wasn't sure on this one, but I was thinking there was a request for us to contact Riverside 9 about the dogs getting into the park. And then
Steve, I think, yeah, for me, I think listening to Ryan Baker's explanation of, you know, our security staff and others contacting, you know, people in the Riverside 9 apartments and, you know, following up on that, you know, I was pretty satisfied with that answer.
Great. Okay. We'll take that one off the list. That's appreciated. And then we've got a request to do some more with respect to describing resource adequacy. That one may take a little time, too.
Yeah. And there's no rush on that. I think a workshop sometime that would just be helpful. So down the road. Okay.
Miss anything?
Commissioners, anything? Okay. And my agenda did not completely print off, so I'm flying. I'm just flying here, Steve. So was there anything else on our list?
We could ask for additional public comment.
Okay. So do we have any additional items to be discussed or members in the public that would like to address the commission? Hearing none, and we do not have an executive session following up, I will call this meeting completed for the day. 25. All right. Thank you all for a great day.